Johnson is about to give evidence to the COVID inquiry, specifically about the impact on young people. And I don't think I need to tell you that he is not a politician that I hold in very high regard. No pleasure whatsoever in being 150% vindicated by his awfulness in office, because, of course, it's the country that suffers, and most obviously, today, it's the young people that suffer. But I'm not sure how much blame you can lay at his feet for decisions made in haste and chaos that ensued. What I really want to talk about today is the actual impacts that that period had on a number of issues that remain in the news.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the government is facing growing pressure over Prince Andrew's titles and living arrangements. It's emerged he's not paid rent on his Windsor home for more than 20 years, as he faces new allegations from Virginia Giuffre. Her posthumous memoir went on sale this morning. LBC's Fraser Knight has more details.
It contains more damning details about the claims that Prince Andrew has always strongly denied. Miss Giuffre talks about three sexual encounters that she claims to have had with the royal after she was trafficked by the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. The first, Virginia Giuffre said, was when she was 17, when she claims to have been told, just like Cinderella, she was going to meet a handsome prince.
The government says Prince Andrew's titles remain an issue for Buckingham Palace. Boris Johnson is to be questioned about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on children. The former Prime Minister will give evidence to the UK COVID-19 inquiry this morning. Public sector borrowing increased to more than £20 billion last month, the highest September figure for 5 years. The cost of debt interest, public services and benefits all increased compared with the year earlier. It piles further pressure on the Chancellor ahead of her budget next month. The Business Secretary, Peter Kyle, who's been speaking to LBC, has denied the country is broke under Labour.
Everything we have done has been within the fiscal rules so that the market can see that we are operating within very tight fiscal rules. And then in doing so, yes, we are investing into our economy, into the skills of our nation, into the innovation of our nation. We are finding ways to make sure that we can get our public services back on their feet, because all of this lays the foundation for economic growth.
The former French president Nicolas Sarkozy is starting a 5-year jail sentence. The 70-year-old, who has lodged an appeal, is being held in the isolation wing of the notorious La Santé prison in Paris. He was found guilty of conspiring to fund his election campaign with money from Libya's Colonel Gaddafi. And Sané Takaichi, who cites Margaret Thatcher as a key influence, has become Japan's first female prime minister. The 64-year-old, who's become known as Japan's Iron Lady, is the country's fourth leader in just 5 years. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 94.33. That's up 29. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 15. LBC weather, sunny spells and scattered showers for many places. The rain heaviest and most frequent in the northwest, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. It's 3 minutes after 10. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I don't know whether you see any sort of warped symmetry here, but the former French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, has gone to jail this morning for conduct committed while in office. Boris Johnson, the former Prime Minister, has just sat down in front of the COVID inquiry, where history suggests he will attempt to obfuscate, fudge and bluster his way out of proper scrutiny. He may well not succeed, because some of his inquisitors are absolutely top drawer. I think Natasha's watching it for us, so we'll be catching up with events at that inquiry as and when they occur. I'm not the world's smartest man when it comes to sartorial observations. When I worked in menswear, I was. You can always spot someone who works in menswear. If you're ever wandering around town and you see somebody coming towards you who is absolutely impeccably turned out, up to and including the occasional excessive accoutrement, like a pocket watch with a chain draped across his waistcoat pockets, or a silk square in his top pocket, the chances are he works in a fancy menswear shop, because you get quite bored. And one of the things you can do when you get quite bored is dress up. But I no longer work in a fancy menswear shop, and I very, very, very rarely dress up. But my first thought on seeing Johnson shuffle into the building was he could have tucked his shirt in. Just a simple thing. He could have tucked his shirt in or ironed his jacket or put on something fresh from the dry cleaners, just by way of conveying how seriously you take the proceedings and how much respect you have for the people that you were talking about, whether they are still with us or not. But that's just me probably being a bit petty. Here's a thing. Right. Just bear with me for a minute on this. There's a story in the news today about Labour considering the abolition of the minimum wage for youths. It's a possible and plausible claim that 16 to 24-year-olds are being priced out of entry-level jobs. Our minimum wage is comparatively high compared to other countries. It's not the highest, but it's higher than comparative economies. And this figure that you know I'm obsessed with, and I think it's possibly the biggest story around at the moment. The only reason I hold back from saying that is because it's not entirely unprecedented. So when I tell you that 16 to 24-year-olds who are not signed up for anything, education, employment, training, are about to hit a million. The figure is about to hit a million. You probably reel. But then I tell you that it actually did hit a million in 2012. But that, of course, was in the aftermath of the global financial crisis and in the dog days of austerity. But it's not necessarily the abolition of minimum wage that we're going to talk about today. I just want you to hold the knowledge that there are a million people in that category now. Category I am absolutely obsessed with, partly perhaps because of my own children's age, although they are not in that category, they're just in that age group, and partly because, well, I'm one of those very odd fish who thinks that patriotism involves thinking about what's best for your country rather than painting roundabouts or putting up upside-down union flags. I know, it'll never catch on, but if you really do understand what patriotic feelings are, it is about wanting what is best for the people in your country. The people. You can't really be patriotic about, in my view, about abstract concepts, but you can be patriotic about human beings, and you can want your neighbours, your friends, your fellow countrymen, and people helping to keep the good ship United Kingdom afloat, albeit that they may have been born somewhere. You want what's best for all of them. It's a desperately unfashionable position, but it's the only truly accurate description of patriotism that you're ever likely to encounter. And I find the idea, and I'm going to sound a bit pompous now, maybe, but I find the idea of a million people not doing anything every day, all day, absolutely heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking and frightening because of what it says about the future. And I'm not sure it's possible to separate the conversation that Boris Johnson will be having today with that figure. Think about AI and the conversations we've had about AI. Imagine you were 18, sitting there, surveying the future, knowing that if you actually went out and got a job, the prospect of ever owning your own home is pretty close to zero. And then, of course, not knowing whether the profession that you've decided to pursue or the job that you've decided to do would even exist in 10 years' time because of all the chatter about AI, which is reaching even the most blocked ears at the moment. Then you've got the existential worries, which you can be sympathetic with or not, but they're real and people worry about them, including the environment, including the rise of the far right, including the possibility that your family's going to be deported if Katie Lamb ever ends up in the Home Office or, God forbid, Downing Street. Then despite the fact that you're here legally, you've abided by all the rules you were required to abide by and you've contributed to this country in all manner of ways, you could easily be deported if politicians like that end up in power. Why would you start on the hamster wheel of life? Why would you start trying to climb up the ladder of life? So I can't separate those two phenomena. The idea that there are reasons why young people in this country today have, if not slipped through the cracks quite yet, then have And I've got the language wrong in the past as well, because what word would you use here? What verb would you use here? Because I was going to say failed to engage with the world. But that's putting it on them. And that's always the temptation in this country, isn't it? It's the tabloidification of the United Kingdom. It's always their fault until suddenly it isn't. Grim news from the grooming gang inquiry today, where two survivors of those horrors have quit the panel with various criticisms. But even there, you know that the victims were routinely blamed in those sort of scenarios and those sort of stories by everybody, until the fact that many or most of the perpetrators turned out to be of Pakistani heritage suddenly animated people who seem to care a lot more about child sex abuse when the culprits are brown than they do when the culprits are white. Again, I suppose, patriotism or love of country would demand that you're equally outraged when your fellow country women are sexually abused, regardless of the ethnicity or the religion of the culprit. But there we are. Two inquiries underway, both designed to make sure that terrible things don't happen again. I don't really understand anyone who's confused about why we have these inquiries, or indeed about how important they are, making sure that terrible things don't happen again. But we don't blame the victims, or at least we try not to blame the victims, on this programme. And the victims of whatever it is that explains this rocketing number, these 1 million young people not doing anything, I think that they are victims. I don't think that they're the architects of their own unhappiness. I don't think that they're the architects of their own disassociation from broader society. And I think, when I look at it, I think COVID had a lot to do with it. I really do. It's such an odd topic of conversation for you and me, this, because there's absolutely nothing we can prove, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong. I kind of hope I am. There's nothing we can prove. Dislocated is a nice word, Mary. Thank you. Yes, these people are, they're socially dislocated, but I don't think they're sociably dislocated. I think an awful lot of them are leading perfectly normal lives. They're essentially leading the lives that they were living when they were in full-time education. They just don't interrupt their days with having to go to school or college anymore. They still live in the same bedroom. They eat the same meals, cooked by the same parent, watch the same screens, do the same stuff. They just don't have anything else going on in their lives. I read at the weekend that Andrew Windsor spends most of his life playing video games these days. I suppose if he was aged 16 to 24, he'd probably qualify as a NEET, albeit that his life remains richly subsidised. It's a dislocated existence. And I can't say I'm certain, because I can't prove it, but I am confident and fearful that the impact of lockdowns and COVID in general is a huge, huge part of this dislocation or alienation. I just am. So I want you today just to tell me how it affected either you, if you're in that cohort of currently being 16 to 24. Because if you're 16 now, you were starting secondary school when everything went nuts. That move, I really don't think we talk about this enough. I just don't. I just think that the whole sort of public school tradition that runs through British society like Blackpool through a stick of rock is about pulling your socks up and getting on with it and stiffening your upper lip, repressing your emotions, dealing with your, or never ever dealing with your traumas. And then, you know, as a society, we reap what that sows. But moving from secondary school, moving from primary school to secondary school, and then not going to school, all of those formative moments, those formative years, absolutely robbed. I think a lot of these children have been robbed. I think they've been burgled of life experiences that are truly formative. I love it when that happens. I must have used the word formative about 10 million times in my life. I've never actually understood it in its purest form as much as I just did in that moment. They've been robbed of the experiences that are formative, the experiences that form them. And because they are, I can't say unformed or deformed, underformed, less formed, because they did not have the formative experiences, they do not have the form that they need to move into elements of this world. So there's two extraordinary prongs there a proper Scylla and Charybdis of unfairness. On the one hand, they do not have the tools or the form that you need to engage. And on the other hand, the reasons for not engaging are siren voices whispering in their ear all the time. What's the point of getting a job? You won't be able to leave home. You'll never be able to buy your own home. Your job probably won't exist in 10 years. AI will get rid of it. And then, of course, on a slightly more dangerous level, you've got the usual liars and racists trying to blame their situation on immigration, which will no doubt be prevalent on TikTok and social media platforms and elsewhere. So, can we try, and I'm on a bit of a hiding to nothing here if you don't help me, can we try and put it into words? Just focus on COVID and lockdowns and schools, what happened in schools. I'm not actually on my high horse about some of the government decisions when it came to that, because I think once Johnson's desire to see COVID run through the population like a dose of salts and leave the bodies piled high on street corners had been dealt with, I think a lot of the decisions taken in the education context were at worst taken in a panicked way. I don't think they were ever designed to make things worse. But that whole thing, that whole saga, that whole era, how did it affect our children? So it's either you or children in your life. And I'd love today to talk to teachers. I think a lot will be on half term, won't they? So it would be wonderful to actually talk to teachers about these unmeasured phenomena. The things that you know in your bones can be traced back to that burglary of formative experience, that theft. I think, personally, at the moment, by the virus rather than by the political decisions, but I'm open to persuasion. Disenfranchised, alienated, whatever it may be. What happened? So, I've done this phone-in, not this one, the other one, about the reasons why so many young people are not engaging with the wider world. And I always have that bubbling away in the background. You can do that. You can come to it with other things, with other explanations, other suggestions as to why it may be. Christopher says his 13-year-old is watching his dad go through his third fire and hire in just over 5 years. They're watching their parents working longer and longer hours and getting less and less for their labour and thinking, why the heck should I bother? I like that. Not as an experience, as an explanation of what's going on. But in the first instance today, it's about how COVID, lockdowns, fear, not just the policy decisions, but the emotional responses, how much of that affected your children, either as a parent or a carer or a teacher or a concerned fellow citizen? I want you to hit the numbers now, and I really want you to talk to me about this, because I think we've done a thing. Is there an evolutionary explanation for sweeping stuff under the carpet and desperately trying to forget it and move on? I couldn't tell you the dates. My own memory has almost shut down in parts, like a sort of glitch, like a reboot, because it was such a weird period. And in many ways, such an unpleasant one, although my family was blessedly spared an awful lot. We've had long COVID in our family, something I'll probably talk to you about more one day. But the simple reality was that we were wealthy enough and together enough to have many, many positives from being cooped up in the house all day. What if you weren't? And my children's schools rose to the challenge. And we are parents with enough time, energy and inclination to make sure they're doing whatever it is that they're being told to do online. But we still have gaps. What did it do to you? What did it do to your families? How much weight should we as a society be placing on what these young people went through when we try to work out why they're doing what they're doing now? That shouldn't be controversial, should it? Or even challenging. Think about those words that I just said. How much weight should we place on what they went through when we're trying to work out what they're doing now? Is there a human being alive who isn't in some way the sum total and the consequence of their own previous experiences? Of course there isn't. It's what makes us. And what made them was trauma, isolation, alienation, fear, confusion, and very, very poor political leadership. 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. What impact did it have? How big a part did those weeks and months and years play in the problems that many of our young people face today? I guess you can do an overview as well. I am. You don't have to talk specifically about children that you know, but I think that would help. And as I say, teachers are particularly welcome today, not least because you're on half term, so you've got no excuse not to call me. 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future, with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Can your phone drown out irritating noises in your videos? Can anybody hear me over this? Luckily, Audio Eraser on the Galaxy S25 Ultra gets rid of background noises in seconds. Can your phone do that? Galaxy can. Get 15% off Galaxy S25 Ultra with code S15.
Buy from Samsung.com by the 21st of October 2025. Use code at checkout. Voucher code can't be combined with any other offer. Samsung account login and network connection required.
Fraud can happen faster than you think. But at Barclays, we use innovative technology that spots fraud in under a second. And our dedicated team of experts work 24/7. So you can go about your day knowing we never stop working to keep you and your money safe. Search Barclays Fraud Protection to see how you can stay one step ahead. Barclays. Make money work for you.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
21 minutes after 10, half term next week for a lot of people, but I'm getting a seat on the bus and on the tube at the moment, so obviously the schools around mine are on half term, but it means some teachers will be a little bit freer than usual, and perhaps best placed to tell us about the impact that the conversation Boris Johnson will be having today, or the things that he will be talking about at the COVID inquiry, how deep they go in the context of young people who are alienated or dislocated, disconnected from our shared society. And I don't blame them. Kirsten's in Kingston. Kirsten, what would you like to say?
Oh, morning, James. I want to raise today about the downgrading of children at particular A-levels in 2020.
Yes.
As we've had in evidence, the intention was that teachers would award grades for students that would then be moderated by the government and Ofqual's algorithm.
Because they couldn't sit the exams.
That's right, yes.
So again, sorry to interrupt, but you probably expect it now after listening to this programme for more than 3.5 minutes.
It's... Oh, couldn't say.
But people will have even forgotten that. A whole cohort of students who never sat their A-levels. People will have forgotten that.
Yeah. No, that's right, GCSEs and A-levels.
Yeah. Sorry, go on.
So the intention, obviously, was that teachers would award the grades and that then they would be moderated by the algorithm to bring grades more in line with previous years. As we've heard in evidence over the past week or two, that evidence or that algorithm, despite the government being warned in advance, was found to be mutant, I think was the word they used, on results day. And the teacher grades were then instated, which for many kids was fine. And this is no impact on the teachers who do an amazing job. But they were given no guidance at all as to how they should award those grades. So in a normal year, you may have, say, 10 kids that are expected to get a grade A. You don't know out of those 10 who are going to get an A.
Sure.
So some schools turned around and went, we'll award all 10 of them an A because we're expecting the algorithm to bring it down. My daughter's school turned around and went, we have to be mindful of our grade awards, and they pre-moderated. So they essentially chose which ones they felt were more likely to get the A. And so there's a group of children who have effectively been downgraded by their schools who were trying, to be fair, to do their best. but with absolutely no guidance from the government as how they should be awarding their grade.
And how I sense this affected one of your children quite directly. How has that impacted on her? Because, you know, I don't know about you, but I put quite a lot of effort into trying to persuade mine that A-level grades aren't that important, because I don't want them to beat themselves up stress-wise and all that. But of course they are. They affect most obviously and most immediately. They affect where you go next, what you do next.
Yeah, exactly. So for her, I mean, in English, for example, she got 2 8s at GCSE. She was told in writing her professional likely grade, they called it, would be an A. She was awarded a B because essentially they ran out of grade A's.
Yeah.
So she got a B. So she was expecting to get possibly A star AB on a good day, more likely AAB. She got BCD. So she was intending to take a gap year anyway. But she her issue is that she's got grades that don't belong to her. They're based on the previous year's cohort.
It's a breach of the social contract at an incredibly early age. I'm not over-egging the pudding, and I hope she didn't, but you could lose faith in, quotes, the system, end quotes, as a consequence of that sort of experience. I presume with a mum like you in her corner, she's done okay subsequently.
She has, good. Yeah. She's graduated. She's actually set up her own business now.
Good.
But it's not just her.
There's a group
of kids that have been downgraded. So, you know, medical places, for example, were lost. Gap years had to be taken. Children losing university places, having to go to different universities.
Or not going to university at all. I mean, there will be, in this figure of a million, there will be loads of people who've had precisely the experience you describe and haven't had the opportunity, the space, the freedom, or the support that they need. Note that I don't say wherewithal or resilience to crack on and push through. Thank you, Kirsten. A lot of people waiting to talk. That's the only reason I'm moving on. And this from someone whose name is right at the top of my screen, but who happily has written in the first line of the message, please don't say my name. But of course, it is absolutely all linked, James. I was in college when we went into lockdown. I was given grades of CDD until they were changed back to my predicted grades of ABB. The shock of those grades in isolation depressed me. University said that they would be introducing study from home models with possible predicted grades, put me off. I now work self-employed in construction, but it's backbreaking work, so I've tried applying for more secure jobs, but they all want degrees. I'm now doing an open university course, but looking at what AI can now do, when I graduate in 3 to 4 years' time, I don't know what entry-level jobs will exist. That lack of hope of ever making your own life, despite trying everything I can to just about keep going, is huge, and I'm not at all surprised that a million or so of my contemporaries can't keep that false hope going. And then the side story of a friend who was getting C's in tests, somehow got predicted B's. Teacher put down they'd get A's. System bumped them up to A star. They went to a great university on day one. While I was searching for what to do with those depressing grades, surprise, surprise, I was at a normal college and they went to private school. Which is why parents pay for private schools to buy unfair advantages. And I'm guilty of it. I do it. My dad did it. I did it. And as long as they exist, many, many parents who don't think the system should exist will continue to do it because they can. Kirsten, thank you. Jason's in Birmingham. Jason, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. I'm just calling with regards to the COVID situation with kids.
Yes.
My son was in his final year of GCSEs. Just a bit of background. I'm not going to take too much of time.
Take as much time as you want.
He had dyslexia when he was young. I think 4 and 5 when he was diagnosed. He had apraxia in his eye, which sort of didn't help him make sentences together.
Okay.
So that's slight background. So as we entered COVID, I think this was the first round. It was December when everything was locked down, and then they slowly introduced the kids to go back. So this was finally at GCSEs. So everything was homeschool learning. He wasn't the best of academic achievers. Sure. I had a daughter younger than him, but she was far brighter and stronger with no SEN issues. Now, in terms of my son, he wasn't the best. The online didn't help him. It deprived him of his social skills. Excuse me.
The
assistance he needed at school.
Had he been doing okay at school up to this point?
He wasn't an A star.
No, I don't care about that, but he was engaged with school. He was going in and he was taking something out of it.
Yes, taking out. He had good friends. The teachers were good with him. He was a bubbly character.
Yes.
Now, since that happened, James, it's like he's been homebound in the sense, not physically, but mentally.
Right.
We can't get him out of the house. He's 20 now, so 3-4 years have passed.
Yeah.
I post-COVID, I tried to enlist him in a college, you know, just to do some vocational work.
Sure.
It didn't help. It shattered his confidence. And as parents, I see my young daughter excelling because she just brushed COVID by because she was far stronger.
Right.
But as parents, we... Well,
don't
we,
say stronger. I'm not going to lecture you on how to parent, but don't say stronger.
Well, she was more... She could cope more better than
That's fine. That's good. Yeah, and I'm sorry for patronising you, but there's a lot of people listening who will balk at that word. Because your boy's not weak.
He's not weak at all. He's really handsome, tall. He's got the body and everything. But academically, he was deprived and his confidence was shattered. Now, as a parent, James, I can't say to him every day, oh, what are you doing?
No.
And as a parent, I just need to get this off my chest because I can't even share this with my wife.
Go on.
It's like I cry to bed to sleep, but without tears.
Yeah.
And I wake up and I put that cloak on, like, oh, you know, everything's going to be fine. But as I see him every day, 24 hours has passed. And he's not getting any younger, and I'm not getting any younger. And how far can I go? But it's just, it's sort of...
doing anything.
He can't have that motivation to get up and do something now. It's destroyed him.
Neither as a psychologist, but part of it will be what's the point? Part of that will be built upon the knowledge that, you know, even if he puts in his best efforts and starts making progress, the rug can be pulled out from the mud. We never had that growing up. We never had that sense of everything that we think is normal is just fragile and temporary, and all it takes is a politician to press a button and our normality disappears overnight. That must have a deep psychological impact on some people, not all people, but some people. And it's impossible to... I mean, you're supposed to sit with their pain. This is what the therapeutic advice says, is that rather than trying to jolly them on or get them out of bed or just play table tennis this afternoon or go for a jog or whatever it is, that can make everything worse. But from a parent's point of view, the hardest thing to do sometimes is nothing.
Yeah, and we've got to keep that brave face on, knowing what we can see what he's struggling through. It's evident. But if I highlight it, I throw him deeper into the hole.
Yeah, I'm sure
you do. And that's all related to the COVID era. And many kids have gone through it, and many parents. So it's not just the children who suffered. We're suffering with them.
Oh, for sure.
Till today. And I just want to get this off my chest.
I'm glad that's what we're here for on days like today. Because, I mean, it is. I think there will be thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in situations similar to yours. Some of the detail will be different. But that notion, I mean, you use the phrase loss of confidence. I've used the phrase theft or burglary. We're describing something that has broken and can probably be healed. But we haven't got the first idea how to heal it. And society, the broader society, has shown no interest whatsoever in helping.
It's like there's no aftercare. It's just you were there, you're lumbered with it, now deal with it and move on. And how do we move on?
And you think your boy's issues are entirely psychological. It's his mental... It's not long COVID. You don't think he's got the virus. He's not physically exhausted all the time or anything
like
that.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's just trying to get him back onto a confidence track, which was always difficult for him because his peers were excelling and he was always left a bit behind.
Yeah.
But I won't say it was not an excuse for him, but
no. It
just works in a way where he just felt really trapped and he's still trapped.
I'm really sorry. I'm so sorry.
Thank you for taking your time and listening, and I appreciate your callers.
You're not alone. You're not alone. That's the only thing I can say to you. And the love that you have for your son is audible. It's shining out through the radio. But that impotence, that inability to be able to help, and the knowledge that when you try to help, you make everything worse. It's like a circle of hell, Jason, for a parent. It must be absolutely unbearable. But as I say, that the hardest pill to swallow sometimes is the instruction that in many circumstances, not all, sitting with the child's pain is what helps them most, telling them how unfair it is, reflecting on how unjust the situation is, rather than doing what, to me at least, and the way I was raised, is the gut reaction, the reflex reaction is like, come on then, off we get, right, do something today, and that can, in many circumstances, make everything worse, whether it's a physical or a mental route to the original condition. It's 10:33. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. We are examining the impact that COVID policy and COVID experiences had upon our children. And we probably should do it more. Here's Thomas Watts with your headlines.
Boris Johnson has denied claims there was no planning for school closures. In his latest testimony to the UK COVID-19 inquiry, the former Prime Minister is giving evidence about the impact of the pandemic on young people. Prince Andrew is under further scrutiny over his living arrangements as his accuser's book goes on sale. It's emerged he's paid only a peppercorn rent on his 30-room Windsor mansion for more than 20 years. Rachel Reeves is facing further pre-budget pressure after September borrowing hit its highest level for 5 years. Public sector net borrowing rose to £20.2 billion last month, driven by debt interest, pay rises and inflation. LBC weather, sunny spells and scattered showers for many places, the rain heaviest and most frequent in the northwest, a high of 16 degrees.
This is LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can wind down and catch up. A chance to let conversations flow and plans unfold. And swap doomscrolling for telling stories. Too good for the group chat. Make the journey part of the joy and save one-third with off-peak group tickets at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
Fraud can happen faster than you think. But at Barclays, we use innovative technology that spots fraud in under a second. And our dedicated team of experts work 24/7. So you can go about your day knowing we never stop working to keep you and your money safe. Search Barclays Fraud Protection to see how you can stay one step ahead. Barclays, make money work for you.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60973.
10:37 is the time, and you know, there is a political dimension to this as well, in that if some of the young people who have been broken by their experiences in recent years, most obviously COVID and lockdown related, end up needing a little bit of help from the state because their anxiety doesn't let them leave the house, they then paint targets on their own backs for people like Honest Bob Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch and the rest of them to come after. What do you think that would do? If you were very, very anxious, or if you were very, depressed, or even if you had a form of post-traumatic stress disorder, and the people running the country or the people aspiring to run the country were deciding to attack you on radio programs and on newspaper pages every day. I'm just wondering whether it might have a negative or deleterious effect as opposed to a positive one, but they don't care. I'll tell you that for nothing. This, James, is frighteningly accurate of my daughter. Your introduction today. She's 19 years old. She went through lockdown, mostly locked away in her bedroom, emerging to find herself terrified of life outside and what she had to do. I have to sit on her bedroom floor with her for several hours as she sobbed, unable to do the things she loved in dance classes because the anxiety that gripped her was so tight. Now she's finished college. She has been diagnosed with depression earlier this year, and she doesn't see the point in life, in living, or in doing anything. She's had job interviews but can't suitably engage to succeed at them, and then gets no feedback from them to learn. The other jobs she applies for get radio silence, further knocking her confidence. COVID and lockdown were turning points from which the fragile confidence she had was utterly stolen from her. And those years from approximately 13 to 15, we've tried so hard to make her see that there is a world out there, but the brick wall seems just too high for her to leap. Oh man, that's beautifully put, but very, very, very poignant. And I've quite a lot of messages coming in like this. It's heartbreaking. Neil says, I agree with you, James. My daughter didn't get to do her last year of primary school, possibly the most formative year of all. She also didn't take either of her SATs and is now expected to waltz into her GCSEs comfortably and confidently. Emma is in Mere in Wiltshire. Emma, what made you pick up the phone?
I have five children ranging from 21 to 10. So while we had lockdown, I had a daughter who was in her GCSE years. I had a son who was studying and picking his GCSEs.
Yeah.
And then I had a child that had started in his first year of primary. The benefits that we saw was my 12-year-old has severe ADHD and high-functioning autism, and he was 2 years behind. They actually picked up all of that and put his EHCP in place, and now he's excelling. So that was amazing. However, that backlog has now come about again. So we have children that don't have EHCPs or aren't getting the correct support, and schools don't have the budgets to support
and
them.
And these are the kids who are still in school, not the 16 to 24-year-olds who are not engaging with anything.
Even the ones that went back, yes. Even the ones that went back, we have social needs in schools that the schools can't support because they don't have the money. So even if you get an EHCP, your child's supported. My 18-year-old, so my 21-year-old got her predicted, they raised her grades to her predicted, she flew through her A-levels, she went to uni, and she's doing very well at uni. But she struggled the first year, being away from home, living with, you know, new people. That's a massive thing anyway in itself. But add lockdown into that, you had to socialise again.
I wonder how many. I mean, the figures of people who went away to university and couldn't quite handle it. And again, I worry about the language. Another thing I worry about language. Quite a few of you picked me up on saying teachers all the time instead of school staff. It's school staff that we're keen to talk to. But the I hadn't thought of that actually, Emma. I know quite a few people who's contemporaries of my daughter who went away to university and have knocked it on the head or come out halfway through the year. I don't know what the figures are for that. And again, the language is so unhelpful because we would call that dropping out, wouldn't we? Which makes it sound like failure or makes it sound like weakness. But if you haven't had the formative experiences that give you the form you need to leave home and go to university, then you get to university or college or away from home, and you find yourself struggling and lacking the tools that you need to get through it. So, you know, a best case scenario is that you would come home in those circumstances and possibly try again next year. And then you become part of this cohort. Then you become part of this phenomenon. Andrea is in Shepherd's Bush. Andrea, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi, James.
Hello,
I just wanted to say that I work in the school. I worked in school during COVID. I was doing outreach work, so I worked with children who were already not in schools. And I could see the effects. My grandson was in year six. And obviously, year six is when you leave to go into year seven for secondary school.
Yes.
And a lot of the year sixes, they never had that transition. So they never had the opportunity to actually go into their secondary schools, have a one day where they would get to go in there, look around, see how the subjects are. So they were just told, okay, there's no school, year seven, log into a computer, and you've got to do all these lessons now. So you're coming from primary to secondary, and it's like, whoa, I've got nobody, no teacher, I've got no...
I think this is huge. This is, and it was unfolding in real time, up and down the country, and no one really clocked it. And the impacts will be now, right? This is the next generation of 16 to 24-year-olds who have not engaged with school or society or the workplace.
Yeah, and then they've got this thing. 2 years later, now get up and go into a school. And it's like, well, how do I readjust myself to that?
Yes.
So, I mean, with me working in a school, I saw it so much that I actually left my job to become a counsellor. So that I can actually help those children. But the government's saying that we need counsellors, we need psychologists, but they're not putting no money into it.
No, well,
so,
there isn't any money.
You're going out there, it's a lot of money to become a counsellor.
Well, it is. No, of course it is, and it's a lot of training, as you would hope and expect. But the point also that you make is that the young people caught in this kind of... catch-22 situation are the most likely ones to become part of the... what do they call it, school refusers as well, and which again is really unhelpful language. School refusing, as if it's a question of won't rather than can't. And, you know, if you've got 20-year-olds who can't get out of the house, then you're going to have 15-year-olds who can't go to school. And all we do in this country is look for ways in which to castigate them rather than counsel them, as you've decided to do. How do we get a handle on how big it is? Because, I mean, the million 16 to 24-year-olds, I haven't got a number for people leaving college in the first year. I haven't got a number for school non-attendance. But I have a sense that every time I read about these phenomena, the numbers are going up exponentially. Everything is growing. And the idea that there isn't going to be a common route for it all, there isn't going to be a common shared experience for these different age groups is absurd. And the common shared experience is going to be COVID and lockdowns on the one hand, and the view of the future on the other.
It's really hard. I mean, it's really sad because you talk to these children, they can't express themselves. Some of them are emotionless. They don't know how to...
What do you mean by that? I know what the word means, but tell me what the children look like.
It means like they can't, like you ask them things and they can't even explain to you what it is they're trying to say. So it's like, oh, I feel sad. And then you're like, well, you know, what do you mean you feel sad? And they can't even explain to you what it is that's making them feel sad. They can't explain to you why they don't want to go to school. It's like, I just don't want to go to school. They can't even articulate what it is that they want to tell you and to say, like, you know, I'm feeling anxious. Okay, yeah, you're feeling anxious, but how? Why? What's it doing to you? What is all, you know, I can't go into a classroom.
And that's learned behaviour.
Stay in their beds and just sleep or pretend they're going to school and roam around the parks or wherever it is and come back home.
Because it's formative, that ability to articulate your emotions, to process them, to work through them. These are formative experiences that happen in socialised environments that have been denied to them. Gosh. Well, I mean, it's brilliant that you're doing what you do, but goodness me, that mountain sounds steep and high. Tony's been in touch, early applicant for Idiot's Corner. He says, the left wing were vociferously supporting lockdowns and closing schools. Have they all got amnesia? Mate, you're going to have an embolism when you find out who was actually running the country during this particular period of history. And of course, the public work with the information that's given them. So I don't think it was ever left wing to say, let's make sure that we protect our vulnerable and elderly people. And the scientists told us that the way to do that was through lockdown. I think it's horrible to think that right wing people somehow happily contemplate the possibility of lots of elderly and vulnerable people dying. The balance needed to be struck. And if they got the balance wrong, then the worst thing you can do is try and turn it into a political point scoring exercise. It is why you have inquiries like the one we're having now, so that we will be much better equipped to cope next time than we were last time. And it's why even I, as possibly the chairman of his anti-fan club, even I wonder how helpful it is to try to blame Boris Johnson or Gavin Williamson for everything that went on. When, I mean, certainly Valance and Whitty were providing them with decent advice, and some of the decisions taken were taken in good faith. I don't know that there is the equivalent to a crony VIP lane in the context of impacts on children. Some of these impacts were unavoidable. The inquiry's job is to establish which ones might have been avoidable to ensure that next time, God forbid there is a next time, they are avoided. 10:47 is the time.
This is LBC.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Tonight's EuroMillions jackpot is £34 million.
I think that deserves a whoop whoop. Whoop whoop! Thank you, faraway person. Get in tonight's EuroMillions draw. Play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the art and design industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Keo, an art and design student in Year 12.
As an art student, we get the chance to work on our own pieces, either in the studio or using the digital software. Some of my work has also been shown in galleries, and last week I got the chance to attend a design agency to learn more about my future career.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year, every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
Next summer sorted. Book a Jet 2 holiday now and take your pick of our best rooms, flights and hotels. You'll get 22 kilograms of baggage included, and right now there's £120 off per couple with MyJet 2. Book now with just a £60 deposit per person and lock in the price for next summer. Jet 2 holidays. Package holidays you can trust. Up to and not protected. Subject to availability and conditions.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
10 minutes to 11 is the time. We'll catch up with Johnson's evidence shortly. Natasha Clark has been watching it so that you don't have to. A couple of you concerned that the thrust of the conversation is suggesting that shutting down schools was the wrong thing to do. I'm not saying that. But clearly the plan in place to look after children caught up in those moments was completely inadequate. And the things that were down to political decisions, like what to do with the children who would miss exams, how the grades would be settled. Listen, two words. Gavin Williamson. Three more words, Secretary of State. Two more words, for education. Come on. A man who could only have flourished in a political environment defined by the lies of Brexit and the primacy of Boris Johnson, one of the biggest liars of all. Putting people like that, and Nadine Dorries was Secretary of State for Culture during much of this period. And just stick that on a postcard. And then reflect upon how so much could go so wrong. So it won't be the simple decisions of, or the science-driven decisions of lockdowns themselves. It will be the politically driven decisions of how to cope with the consequences. And of course, that line about letting the bodies pile high in the street would be the man who ended up in charge. Elizabeth is in Ascot. Elizabeth, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. What an emotive conversation.
Yes, it is.
So I've got a 16-year-old who finished his GCSEs this summer, came out with ones and twos instead of fours and fives at least to pass, along with all his peers. All his friends came out with the same grades. A child who didn't get to sit his SATs. At the time when he was in year six, I had enough money to put him through tutoring for the SATs. Then obviously COVID hit, so we didn't do the SATs. He didn't go to school up until maybe, I think, half of year seven. He always talks about year seven being his best year, though, so he did really enjoy when he entered.
I bet he did. Lucky enough not to have been socially damaged. He couldn't wait to see his mates.
They had masks on for a good, 3 or 4 months in. And he loved it, and he still talks about it now. But then what ensued was, when I think about it, I don't know what happened between years seven and year nines, because come to year 10, and now we had a cohort of about 30 boys that the school kept complaining about that my child was part of that couldn't settle down into the whole GCSE, getting ready for their GCSEs. And they just couldn't get a hold of these kids, and all they did was fight fire with fire and discipline them continuously and put them in isolation rooms and detentions and suspensions. My child was suspended for the most randomest, silliest things. I had to complain. I had to write letters. I went in. I was trying to be a good, supportive mum. I wanted to show the school that I was on the side of the school, that I was here to support my child, et cetera, et cetera. And nothing worked.
My child left with
a one and a two.
And that, of course, leaves big question marks over what he's going to do next.
So, no, because fortunately for myself, I've got my own business.
Right.
I've got a small business.
Well, but yeah, that puts you in a small category, doesn't it, of parents who might be able to ease their children into the workplace that way.
We applied for college. We applied to do a marketing T-level. You know, he did the interview. They loved him at the interview because he talked about the things that he'd done in the personal business, et cetera, et cetera. And then when we went to sign up for the course, they said, it's full, there's no space, you didn't get the grades anyway, so you're not coming in. And the woman berated us at the open day, and I couldn't believe the conversation she had with us. And in front of my child, had she said it directly to me, but it had been on the IOM ladder, I would have taken it differently. But in front of my child, she berated him and me, and she said things like, you need to go to another college, here it's full. And she said, everywhere's going to be full now. I said to her, well, what should we do? What does a child do? What does the government say we should do if there's no space for you to resit your maths and English? And she would say, that's not a question for me that you have to go and ask the parliament. And that conversation led, James, to me rebooking another appointment at another college. And at that college, my son saying, I'm not getting out of the car, Mum. Yeah. I'm not going to college. He was so traumatised by the way that this woman has spoken to us.
And that's with full parental support from you. And something else struck me while you were talking, which was if some of the things you've described are, as seems very likely from all our callers today, a consequence of isolation that was suffered during lockdown, the idea that you address behaviour that is a consequence of isolation by using more isolation as a punishment is barbaric. It's obviously barbaric. And again, I mean, you're free to criticize individual teachers. I wasn't there. Certainly the lady at the college sounds pretty hideous. But for teachers who have only got the systems of discipline in place that they had before COVID, they haven't got a new language to speak or a new vocabulary of discipline and punishment. They're going to carry on using the punishments that they used before, even though they may have become supremely unfit for purpose. Speaking of unfit for purpose, Boris Johnson was Prime Minister during this period, and it is his testimony to the COVID inquiry that prompted our conversation this morning. Natasha Clarke has been watching it. What can you tell us?
Yeah, morning, James. So this is module 8 of the COVID inquiry. It's looking, as you've been talking about for the last hour, at the impact of the pandemic on children and young people in England, Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland. It's talking basically about the impact of the pandemic on closing schools, on those with special educational needs, those with disabilities. And of course, we've been hearing from Boris Johnson today. He basically spent the last hour defending that the government, accusations that the government didn't have a proper plan for shutting schools back in March 2020. But he says this morning that looking back, it was right to ask if there was an alternative to this, but at the time he didn't think that there was.
If you look at what I said in Cabinet, I think on the 11th of March, I may have got my dates wrong, but I say that we will come under increasing pressure to close schools. And I was always grimly reconciled to the possibility that we would have to do all sorts of things that I really didn't want to do. But I was also determined to try and keep schools open if I possibly could. And, you know, I've got to say that given the huge damage that the closures have done, and given the loss of life chances that they've caused, you've got to ask yourself now whether we could have found other ways of reducing the budget of risk in from COVID. Could they, if they were 10 to 20% of the R, was there some way of doing it without school closures? Now, all the advice I was getting was absolutely not. You've got to do this.
And as I said, he was really being grilled by the main lawyer today at the inquiry on Gavin Williamson's claims the last week that there was a dereliction of duty by not planning enough. He insisted that he did not think that was the case.
So you don't accept that the evidence from the then permanent secretary that there was no contingency plan for school closures, or there wasn't planning that focused on the potential for mass school closures, you don't think that that's a dereliction of duty? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I can only repeat what I've just said. I understand, you know, I know that Mr. Slater later resigned. I though not over that matter as far as I can remember. I don't think, you know, if you're the perm sec at the DfE, there's nothing to, there was certainly no, let me put it this way, there was absolutely nothing coming from the central government to say you must not on any account prepare for school closures. On the contrary, anybody looking at what was happening would have assumed that school closures were something that had to be encompassed and prepared for. And from what I can see of the department's thinking, they were indeed doing that.
Claire Dobbin asking the questions, as you say, Natasha, very strong lines of questioning. How long is he there for?
He's there all morning. We've got a different witness coming up this afternoon, but I think this is probably the last time that Boris Johnson will appear at the COVID inquiry. And like I say, before was very much focused on sort of the government decisions that they were taking. This is meant to be focusing on children. It does feel like he's a bit more relaxed, I think, than he was at the last one. He felt very prepared, very scripted last time. And I think, understandably, you know, the reaction he got, you know, was terrible. He was being booed. He was getting victims, you know, standing up and protesting. He hasn't seen any of that this time, but he did hop in at 7 o'clock this morning to try and avoid the TV news cameras really, really early in there. So yeah, I imagine that there will be some victims meeting him outside the court later today, and there will be many people that say, of course, there was a dereliction of duty. You didn't do enough planning for schools, for lockdowns, and you were focused on the NHS and other things.
Well, he also put a lot more effort into reopening pubs than he did into reopening schools, which some of us observed at the time. But the takeaway here, I think, for me, is that the scientists get the yay or nay on the wisdom or otherwise of lockdowns, and they were fairly united that schools should have been shut. But it's the politicians, most obviously Gavin Williamson and Boris Johnson, who have responsibility for how the country helps them once their schools are shut, how the country copes once the schools are shut, both in the moment of school closures and with the broader issues like exams and gradings and catch-up and the stuff that they have lost. And they are loggerheads with each other.
Yeah, that's right. And we haven't got on to Gavin Williamson's claims about what happened during the second and third lockdowns and how that impacted on children. And Gavin Williamson was saying some quite damning evidence last week that he felt that the decision to close schools in January 2021 was basically taken in 24 hours without his consultation, without his knowledge, and without really any planning for what that would look like. And that's an accusation I'll be keeping a bit beady eye on later when Boris Johnson's asked about it.
Thank you very much indeed, Natasha Clark. They're reflecting on Boris Johnson's early contributions to the COVID inquiry on the question of impacts on children. And we've had an extraordinary conversation. If you didn't hear it, then don't forget you can listen on catch up on the LBC app. Up next, probably, although I always reserve the right to change my mind in the moment, you will never guess which highly august publication, which rules out the Daily Mail, a highly august publication has just called for cocaine to be legalised. I'll tell you after this.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Boris Johnson has denied his government failed to plan for school closures in England during the pandemic. The former Prime Minister is giving evidence to the UK COVID-19 inquiry about the impact on children and young people. He's described the closure of schools as a nightmare scenario, but Mr. Johnson's insisted he had no choice.
My impression was that everybody understood that school closures was part of the toolkit that we might sadly have to use, and we were being forced by events and by the spread of the disease to deploy that solution much earlier than we wanted.
Prince Andrew is facing further pressure over his royal titles and living arrangements. It's emerged he's paid only a peppercorn rent on his 30-room mansion on the Windsor estate for the last 20 years. Andrew, who denies any wrongdoing, is facing fresh scrutiny over claims in his accuser, Virginia Giuffre's posthumous memoir. Jack Royston, chief royal correspondent at Newsweek, says he's not out of the woods yet.
if the Metropolitan Police are taking a look at, which does not quite mean yet investigating, these claims that he asked his police protection officer to dig up dirt on Virginia. We don't know what he says about it. He might well deny it. But there is a real prospect that anybody considered to be involved in a conspiracy to commit misconduct in a public office could be hauled in.
Rising debt interest, pay rises and inflation all helped to push up the deficit last month. Government borrowing rose to £20.2 billion, the highest September figure in 5 years. It puts further pressure on the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, ahead of her budget next month. The Chancellor is setting out plans she claims will save British firms almost £6 billion a year. The changes are designed to simplify reporting rules, reducing the amount of paperwork smaller firms need to file with Companies House. And the Met Office has issued yellow weather warning for wind and rain across large parts of the UK on Thursday. Forecasters are expecting winds of up to 75 miles per hour and flooding in places. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 94.22. That is up 19. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 15. LBC weather, sunny spells and scattered showers for most today. The rain heaviest and most frequent in the northwest, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 5 minutes after 11. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Every day's a school day. I like this from Julian. I had no idea that august could be used as an adjective. Thank you, James. I feel ever so slightly less dense now. I hope I got that right. Quite often when you pick up on things like, I've got quite an odd vocabulary, not as old as Boris Johnson's. I just love words. Do you know, I love words so much that I was walking up the corridor earlier today and I noticed that Dan Walker, who does the Classic FM breakfast show, he's taking a few days off. I was just walking past the studio when I heard him announce it. And then Jenny, who does the Smooth FM breakfast show, is on holiday this week. So Adil Ray is standing in for her. And when Dan goes away, Alid Jones stands in for him. And there's something about my brain that's utterly delighted by the fact that Adil and Aled will be sitting there. I know there's not a full reflection. There's like an I and an E. But something about that just delights me. And I don't know why. You probably think I'm weird now, don't you? But I just thought, oh, that sort of put a little bit of Adil and Adil. Adil and Adil. So anyway, don't listen to them, though. Listen to me. I'm here all week. When I first started in this job, I was quite wet behind the ears. I was a bit of a wunderkind. I don't know that you would get the opportunity to slide into the mid-morning slot as a relatively youthful unknown today. LBC is a much bigger beast than it was back then. And I was quite a lot younger than everybody else on the payroll. It's a little bit of me that thinks I still am. But of course I'm not. I'm quite the opposite. That's what happens when you do a job for 20 years. I've still got that mindset of being the sort of newish kid on the block. Probably because I came on after Ferrari when I started. And I still come on after Ferrari now. And the gap between our age group, our two ages, has stayed exactly the same during the intervening period. That's not an opinion, that's counting. And when I started, I was very open about the fact that I'd had a fairly long and enthusiastic relationship with cannabis. And it meant, I felt, and I think still correctly, that when we had conversations about cannabis in particular, which was a hardy perennial of the phone-in radio paradigm, and indeed still blamed by the editor of the Daily Mail for everything from, I don't know, the siege of Mafeking right through to the end of civilization as we know it, I could actually speak from experience. And I think that was really helpful, and it was quite refreshing. And it made for much more illuminating and interesting phone-ins than it would have done if I'd sat here in complete ignorance, inviting you to ring in with various ill-informed and ignorant opinions. Which brings us to cocaine, which I can't remember ever having a conversation about the legalisation of, and which is not a conversation. I nearly said sadly then, but it's not a conversation I do have the qualifications and experiences to conduct in the way that I could conduct conversations about cannabis. Somebody once said to me that the worst thing about cocaine is it just makes people talk about themselves endlessly. And then I thought, well, there's no point me taking that then, is there? Because I already suffer from elements of that condition. And I wouldn't normally talk about it, but the source of this call to make cocaine legal is the British Current Affairs publication, The Economist. A bastion of classical liberal philosophy, it says here, since 1843. The argument is quite straightforward. Legalising the Class A drug would eliminate the price premium, which lines drug dealers' pockets and drugs gangs' pockets. It would take pressure off the creaking criminal justice system and ensure that the product's dosage and quality was safer for consumers. They acknowledge that it's unlikely to enjoy much support among voters and politicians, but I'm a big fan of things that don't enjoy much support among voters and politicians, but actually do turn out to be the right thing to do. And I just wonder whether you think this one is. The most effective single way, this is in the leaders column in this week's edition, the most effective single way to reduce the death, violence and corruption would be to legalize and regulate the production and consumption of cocaine. This would eliminate the price premium that motivates the world's most violent criminals. Consumers could be sure of dosage and quality, an incentive to shun dangerous, illegal concoctions. Seriously, pay attention, because this is moving into what's not to like territory with every sentence. Prisons would be emptier, and the criminal justice system could focus on deadlier synthetics. Alas, in most consuming countries, neither voters nor politicians are interested. Without legislation, the fight against illicit drugs is uphill. If the immense harm they cause is to be reduced, Mr. Trump will have to shift his strategy to reflect the new narconomics, no matter how dramatic hellfire strikes may look on TikTok. How many seizures do you think the police made in England and Wales last year? Just under 21,000, the highest again since 2009-2010. And I don't know, so I have friends who have had problems with cocaine. It's hardly surprising. I was a showbiz journalist and I went to public school. I've had a couple of friends who've been in rehab. I've got two very good friends who met in rehab and they're still together. And I've seen the appalling damage it can do to people, but that happened when it was illegal. I like this argument. I like the philosophy of it and the sophistry of it, because I don't, as I say, generally conduct drugs phone-ins in the way that you've probably heard them conducted elsewhere, which involves a lot of people who don't know what they're talking about with incredibly strong opinions, or one or two experiences that we're supposed to use to decide what the policy should be for an entire population. So I have friends who have had cocaine addiction, have been addicted to cocaine. I think they would tell me that they still are, they're just not using it, that you never cease to be an addict. You just move into recovery. And because my friends were from relatively wealthy backgrounds, the damage it did to the fabric of their existence was limited. You know, they spent money that they could just about afford to spend. So, and sort of two of them in particular were spending a lot of money, and secretly as well. One of them went through an inheritance at a speed that we found genuinely shocking when he finally got around to telling us. But that all happened while it was criminalised and while it was illegal, which means that an awful lot of that money made its way into the pockets of some of the most unpleasant people on the planet. Trace it way back to source, and you are talking about cartels in Colombia and killers in South America and elsewhere. And these bad things happened while it was illegal. I'm probably going to say that again and again and again and again. I am not on the same page as The Economist at this point in proceedings, precisely because cocaine is so addictive and potentially so damaging. But all of the bad stuff we've experienced happened while it was illegal. So the big brains at The Economist are, I think, on almost unshakable ground when they point out that if it was legal and regulated, if it was made essentially in government-sponsored laboratories, then all of the profits would make their way back into the clean economy, the non-criminal economy. All of the drugs that people were still buying and taking would be measurably safer. And the bit I'm a little bit worried about is probably cheaper. But the criminal underworld that absolutely relies upon this would be cut out of the picture entirely. 0345 6060 973 is the number you need to share your views on this question, the rights and the wrongs of it. And I think, you know, telling me how awful it is and how much it ruined your life is fine, but that happened while it was illegal. So it's not actually, unless I'm missing a massive point here, an argument against legalizing something is not, oh, it ruined my life while it was illegal. Do you see what I mean? It doesn't quite work like that. At least not from where I'm sitting. And these are the bits you can't argue with. Without legalization, the fight against illicit drugs is uphill. Yeah, but you could easily frame that as surrender. Surrender to what? The immense harm they cause, if you want to see it reduced, you're going to have to change strategies. Hard to argue with that. Prisons would be emptier. Can't argue with that. Criminal justice system could focus on other issues, including deadlier synthetics. Can't argue with that. Cocaine is, I suppose, organic, isn't it? It comes from a plant. And the much more dangerous illegal concoctions would lose their appeal, I presume, if cocaine was legally and relatively freely available. And the other issue with legalization, I've never ever got my head around, is this, and I can't really answer this question, is if it's legal, do you become more likely to take it? And if you become more likely to take it, do problems and addiction rates rocket while it's legal? Because an awful lot of people have used cocaine, are using cocaine, will use cocaine, who have a perfectly pleasant and manageable experience. That's another element of drugs conversations that's often missing from the sort of tabloid treatments. The massive majority of drugs users, all drugs in fact, I don't know about some of the sort of more recent and modern ones, but historically speaking, an awful lot of drug use is relatively innocuous. People don't get addicted. People don't do terrible things. People don't steal to feed their habit. Those would be the fringes or the extremities of the cohort of users. And by legalizing it, do you increase the amount of peril that the population is being put in, or do you decrease it? There it is. Oh, I love it when that happens. That's the question that's popped out the bottom of our pontifications. When you legalize it, do you increase the amount of peril that a population is exposed to? And remember, peril comes in many forms. It could be the crimes that are being committed to pay for the illegal drug. It could be the delays in the court system caused by the disproportionate number of cocaine-related offences in the mix. It could be the violence. So the peril, the objective peril, this is the utilitarian argument, isn't it? The greater good. Do you increase or decrease the amount of peril a population is exposed to when you legalise cocaine? I can see fairly strong arguments, and I'm not sure I could see them quite so clearly before The Economist jumped into this particular space, that it actually increases. That having it as an illegal drug increases the amount of peril that the population is exposed to. Come at it from whatever angle you want, but try to have a little nod at that bit of it, if you want. That the idea of it being a philosophical question rather than necessarily a pharmaceutical one. And the number you need, as always, is 0345 6060 973. Let's remember to do the international on this as well. I can never remember. I know Portugal's gone quite far on decriminalisation or legalisation, but are there countries where cocaine is legal? And I've got no more sophisticated question. What's that like then? Are there any countries where cocaine is legal? And if so, what's that like then? Hit the numbers now, you will get through.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling, Don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
19 minutes after 11 is the time. Do you know how Mystery Hour started? It started with a couple of questions that popped up on the programme because we were trying really hard to go beyond the usual questions on a given subject. And I think one of the questions that made us think maybe we could just do a whole hour of questions every day, every week. Why is gold valuable? Do you think it just must be obvious, right? Why is gold valuable? Why is gold valuable? And Mystery Hour was born. So I'm going to add one of those star questions, albeit the switchboard's quite busy. Why are drugs illegal? 0345 6060 973. So the central question is, do you agree with The Economist magazine that cocaine in particular should be legalised because of the enormous impact it would have on everything from the criminal justice system to the economy? And while we're at it, does anyone want to have a go, either historically or socially, at the question of why drugs are illegal in the first place? 20 minutes after 11 is the time. Chris is in County Durham. Chris, what would you like to say?
I just heard you talking, and I've got to say, I vehemently disagree that it should be legal. We spoke before, after Matthew Perry died, actually. And I phoned up to tell you how horrendously addicted I was to cocaine and drugs and alcohol. And I happily can say that I'm a lot better now.
Oh, mate, well done.
However, 7 months ago on Mother's Day, I tried to end my life. Because the constant knocking of the drugs is horrendous. And a lot of other, I was talking to your researcher there, often a celebrity, when they die, they're found with drugs in the system. Ricky Hatton just ended his life with cocaine in the system. And I could only assume from my experience that it would be for the same reason, that it's unmanageable.
So these are chemical arguments, aren't they? They're not social or philosophical arguments.
No, I mean, in terms of the philosophical argument, I have no problem with it.
Sure.
Take the drugs off the streets and take it away from the bad people. But I think that we can't, as human beings, be trusted with something that's so addictive. There's lots of things that we're not allowed, and for good reason.
Well, yeah, and there's lots of things we are allowed for good reason as well. And I mean, if I was feeling glib, I'd say video games can be incredibly addictive, but I'm not, so I'll just say alcohol.
Very true, and again, lots of people... have alcohol misuse problems.
But we wouldn't use that. Well, would we use that as a rationale for criminalising alcohol?
We could.
I know, but would we?
I think if alcohol was around, was just coming here now into society, we would probably be having the same discussion that we're having about cocaine.
And look where we are. I mean, we had that discussion. We didn't legalise it or prohibit it. Massive, and this is the point, and I'm going to be sensitive, Chris, because I hope you'll let me say I'm really proud of what you've done. I think that's a fantastic, because I do remember your call. the massive majority of people have relatively healthy relationships with drugs that some people have appalling relationships with, and that would include alcohol and cocaine. So do we use the hideous experiences? And remember, what happened to you happened while it was illegal. So it's not an open and shut case that legalizing it makes things worse, because your terrible experiences happened while it was illegal. And that would have exposed you to criminality and probably to debt. It would have exposed you to dangerous agents that the cocaine had been cut with. It would have exposed you to all sorts of perils that would be removed by legalization. So if we were to just sort of add up credits on one side where things get better and debits on the other side when legalization makes things worse, I don't think it's as obvious as you think it is.
Except that I think cocaine's main purpose of existence is to make you want more.
I mean, everything's like that. The internet's like that now. Facebook's like that. This radio program is like that. Sugar's like that.
Yeah, but I think the amount of damage that it does to your body, I've got a massive hole in my nose and have constant problems with it.
And again, you're putting me in a slightly tricky situation here where I've got to argue with you. Because, again, the massive majority of people who have taken cocaine have not ended up anywhere close to where you've ended up.
No, but
what do we think? I want to tread very, very carefully, because I'm conscious of what you said happened 9 months ago. And of course, anybody who is struggling with similar issues should know that the Samaritans are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on 116123. But I'm thinking about ease of access. That would be an obvious problem from your point of view, wouldn't it? If it's easier to get hold of, it's harder to give up. But if it's if it's regulated, I sound a little bit naive, but you could be on a register of people who have opted in to being refused service in all government-funded facilities or government-sponsored facilities.
It seems like a backward step. You know, we're trying to get rid of tobacco as much as possible.
They're never going to criminalize it.
No, I mean, like I say, from a libertarian point of view, I do agree that we should have free choice to put whatever we want in our bodies, to be entirely honest.
Except you don't.
and for good reason, and this is one of the good reasons.
I'm not sticking my flag in the Economist's lawn at the moment. I'm just fascinated by so many elements of it, and yours is going to be the hardest to overcome, but neither of us can prove that it would actually increase the likelihood of people ending up in the situation you've ended up in. Do you want to have a crack at the big one? Why are drugs illegal?
Because a lot of people make a lot of money from it, and
how about that? Now you're on the same side as the Economist. Because if you legalize it, then the people making money from it will be governments, and they can spend that money on everything from the NHS to I don't know, filling in all the blooming potholes. Chris, stay safe, and seriously, I know a lot of people listening will join me in saying how delighted they are for you and how proud that you've managed to push through to a much better place than you were in last time we spoke. Henry is in Hackney. Henry, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. First-time caller.
Welcome.
How are you?
Very well, mate. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so I just pulled in because in between a couple of work calls, I heard the topic of discussion, and I actually wrote my dissertation all the way back in 2016 on the history of criminalisation and its origins in the US.
Undergraduate, master's or PhD?
So I did an undergraduate, that was my dissertation. I went on to do a master's in something else.
Not good enough. We had a PhD thesis relevant to yesterday's phone-in, mate, so you're in second place on academic qualifications. Carry on.
Yeah, okay, well, most people think it's a waste of time.
No, it is never a waste of time to learn stuff or to study. Go on.
But if you look at the origins of criminalisation in the US, and most Western drug laws are based on the US model, right?
Right.
So if you go to the late 1800s, early 1900s, basically opium was first criminalized to target Chinese immigrants in San Francisco.
Sure.
Similarly, cocaine laws were driven by racist hysteria about black men in the South, and then, you know, cannabis in the 1930s being called marijuana to associate it with the influx of Mexican immigrants, right? So Yeah, exactly.
Just back up on the cocaine and black people line. I don't know that sure. line. Sorry. Go on.
Yeah, exactly. So without talking about some of the kind of terms that they would use, but yeah. obviously when slavery ended, you then had the kind of apprenticeship, you had apprenticeships, and then it moved into Jim Crow, right?
Yes.
And as it was no longer feasible at a federal level to discriminate and criminalize people based on, you know, their ethnic subdivisions, what they did was use hysteria to associate the so-called cocainized N-word with the ability to, you know, rape your women, steal your cars, and it actually led to multiple police forces in the Deep South upgrading their caliber of bullets because they believed that the bullets that they had in their guns wouldn't be strong enough for the so-called cocainized N-word. So that's just a little bit of, on the origins. Now, I'll talk for England, but yeah.
No, you and me both, mate, but you're being a lot more interesting than me at the moment. So, in fact, what I'm going to do, with your permit, do you have to get back to work? Can I take a news bulletin back to you?
Yeah, I've delayed my next meeting to talk to you.
That's what we want to hear. There you go. An undergraduate thesis. Andy's delayed his next meeting, and you can see why. This is absolutely fascinating. Let's get the headlines from Thomas Watson and return immediately afterwards.
Boris Johnson has rejected claims there was no planning for mass school closures in England during the pandemic. He's insisted the Department for Education did its best to remediate the damage and to support pupils. The government's facing growing pressure over Prince Andrew's titles and living arrangements. It's emerged he's not paid rent on his Windsor home for more than 20 years, as he faces new allegations in Virginia Giuffre's memoir. Two more men have been arrested in connection with the death of the former Lost Prophets frontman Ian Watkins. They're being questioned on suspicion of conspiracy to murder over his death at HMP Wakefield earlier this month. LBC weather, sunny spells and scattered showers for many places, the rain heaviest and most frequent in the northwest, a high of 16 degrees.
LBC.
Sandy!
Wes! You're looking chirpy.
I'm off on a tour of London with my mates. Got a great deal of SWR rewards.
Ooh, not bad. I got a deal on theatre and dinner, so I'm taking my girlfriends.
You are such a culture vulture.
Wes!
Make every trip a treat with SWR Rewards. Book a train from Chilworth today to claim yours. Southwestern Railway. Spread your wings. T's and C's apply.
One of the most important things for me is to break that cycle of addiction. It stops with me. And to do that, I knew that I had to get better, and I had to show my boys that, okay, I've got a really big problem. I'm willing to solve it.
Start your recovery with Priory. To learn more, visit priorygroup.com/breakthechain.
ITV presents...
Oh, my God.
Gas!
There is a chemical weapon in the cab.
We are dealing with a serial killer.
The devices are designed to kill, but first he wants to suffocate them. I'm spent.
I can't watch you give everything until you've got nothing left.
I take risks. That's my job.
Help! Lana!
Hold your breath.
Lana!
Trigger Point returns October 26 on ITV1 and ITVX.
Every parent has the key to unlock their child's potential. A future where they learn the skills they need to succeed. Whether that's getting a job or further study. But the key isn't the key. It's the support you give them.
All right, Dad.
Fancy a brew and a natter, son. I've been reading about technical education and it looks the business.
Technical education opens doors for your child. Search Talking Futures to find out how T-levels, apprenticeships and HTQs can unlock their full potential.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
32 minutes after 11, The Economist calling for cocaine to be legalised with a long list of reasons in support of the thesis. And in philosophical terms, it's utilitarianism, the greater good. More good would be caused by the legalisation than by the continued criminalisation, which also prompted me, because that's the way my brain works, to wonder out loud why some drugs were rendered illegal in the first place, which is where Henry and Hackney came in with some absolutely fascinating insights gleaned from his own undergraduate studies. So I've got that. And I suppose we should add to the mix the fact that a lot of people of Chinese heritage, or a lot of Chinese people who were addicted to opium, was a direct consequence of British foreign policy back in the day. But carry on. So we follow where America leads, and America's lead was often defined by attempts to discriminate or control ethnic minorities.
Yeah, so exactly. So they're the origins of the law, but obviously it was made worse under Nixon's war on drugs. That's the one that everybody kind of knows about in the 1970s.
Because he lost in Vietnam.
Exactly. It was to criminalise anti-war protesters and, again, black communities. And I'm sure you've got lots of callers listening in thinking that's a woke leftist, is all nonsense. Please feel free to do your own research. It's absolutely true. And I think, sorry, go ahead, James.
No, I'm literally just making noises of appreciation, Henry. Please ignore them.
So I was very close to writing, I recently was unemployed and for a few months and was going to write a LinkedIn post about this very thing. So the thing that I think is most important, when we look at the kind of the state of the UK economy at the moment, the fact that we're massively in debt and we're spending around, I think, close to £2 billion a year just policing and prosecuting drug offences, whilst the estimates, you know, of the illegal drug market in the UK is about £10 billion annually. Obviously, we have no idea if that's close.
Sure.
But that money's going straight into the hands of organised crimes. And those gangs use the profits to fund violence, trafficking, exploitation. And we've just handed them this monopoly. So for me, if we legalised and regulated drugs, we take that money away from criminals and we put it under state control. And then I did a little bit of research while I was waiting. I think, like, cautious estimates, it could generate like £3 to £5 billion a year in tax revenue, and that's obviously been seen, for, you know, in Canada with the legalization of cannabis. So it could almost
make up for Brexit, Henry.
Well, I don't think anything can make up for Brexit. But
are there any countries where it has been done with cocaine specifically, as opposed to cannabis? Do you know?
So there's in certain US states, if you look at, I'm thinking of Oregon, they have decriminalized personal amounts of all drugs.
Okay.
Now the statistics are obviously highly distorted when you've got the likes of like Governor Greg Abbott busing loads of homeless people to places like Portland to you know, have homeless people to kind of get them off the streets in Texas and shuttle them all the way out to Oregon. But the problem is with decriminalization, I like to refer to it as criminalization light. So whilst it's better for kind of outcomes for drug users in the sense, like, you know, that they're not, you know, crouching down in an alleyway to shoot up with a dirty needle using, there's still the problem of it being procured through the black market. I just think the best thing we could possibly do is have a fully regulated service where people could go in, procure their drugs, know what the quality of the drugs are, and then with the taxation that you would raise for that, you could then offer people, you know, support, advice, rehabilitation if necessary, and the whole system would be so much cheaper than the current war on drugs, which, you know, we've spent trillions, if you look at the US as well, trillions of dollars fighting, and drugs are purer, cleaner, and more abundant than ever before.
I think that final point is particularly pertinent because I think many people who think that this is a slam dunk from the other side of the court, that it is a stupid idea because of stories like Chris's, who was on before you, of people suffering appallingly from addiction issues, that they would be stunned to discover just how easy everything is to get hold of these days. So the idea that making it legal would somehow cause a proliferation of access is probably a little bit pie in the sky.
Yeah, well, I think that, so you always get that one person during my dissertation that when I told people what I was writing my dissertation on, there was one woman I remember, she was like, you're suggesting what? Legalizing heroin? She said, everyone will do heroin. And I just asked her the question, if heroin was legalized tomorrow, would you go out and do heroin? And she said, well, of course I wouldn't. And I'm like, well, there's your answer. And again, using the money that you would raise from the legalization, you could funnel that into education programs so people know what they're taking, the risks associated therein. Look at smoking cigarettes, right? Since they've hidden them away, since they've made them £20 a pack since they put those horrible graphics on them. Smoking rates in the West are declining every year. So for me, it just seems logical, and I can't believe the Economist of all papers have suggested this.
Well, until you remember what liberalism means in its purest form before it got sort of co-opted and hijacked by weirdos. I mean, this is liberalism in its purest form, but it's not necessarily underpinned by the evidence that you've provided. Those simple things. and the money would be used to help people who need help, among lots and lots and lots of other things.
That's it.
Why didn't you stay in this on this path? Just opportunities didn't come, because I mean you've clearly got a proper passion for it.
it's a good question. You know, I've just been a little bit disillusioned by politics for basically my entire adult life. And
yeah, but apart from that,
I mean, yeah, it's something that people ask me. Yeah, I work in later life lending now, mortgages, sure. but it's something that I'm extremely passionate about. And obviously, seeing Zach Polanski say that, it's really, really, it's really, you know, impressive and something I could definitely get behind. And people will see the benefits, right? You talk about crime on the streets, you talk about county lines, drug gangs, you would solve that overnight by legalizing and regulating. Why would you go to a guy down the street to buy your, would you buy a bottle of moonshine from a guy on the street, or would you go to Lidl to buy your cheap vodka? It's just logical, in my opinion. I know.
You see, you're a man on a mission. It's a real piece of luck on our part to have you. I mean, a lot of people are suggesting I give you a Ray Liotta. I don't know if you know what that means.
No.
It's like the highest honour that we reserve for contributors to the programme whose qualifications are actually off the charts. And I think, not on the first bit, but because you've backed it up, you've answered both questions, which I wasn't really expecting anybody else to do. You can, obviously it's not going to mean anything to you, but it means an awful lot to many people listening.
I'm Ray Liotta, and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC.
Wow. If you build it, they will come.
So that's the thing, right? We built it, you came. Thank you, Henry. Get back to work, you're late for your meeting.
I need to go.
It's coming up to 20 to 12. All human life is here. Bob's in Croydon. Bob, what would you like to say?
Hi, Bob. We spoke before. I've come under a different name this time. I'm actually a full citizen. I just wanted to shed a different light for it, you know. Well, firstly, I'd like to say that the help isn't there for the forces. When they've left Afghan, when they've left Iraq, especially me, especially for my comrades, all suffering, and we're self-medicating, the service is not there. And that's the first issue I would like to raise.
Good. I'm glad you have raised that. I think it's a really important issue. Where do we stand on the legalisation then of some of the things that you break the law by self-medicating?
For me, it's a two of one, half a dozen of the other. Yeah. On one hand, it's like being an ex-addict of myself. It really doesn't matter, mate. It's on every street. Doesn't matter. You can get it. If I tapped in today,
yeah,
I could have it on my doorstep in 10 minutes. That's mad.
Just dumped you for the language there, Bob. Not for any other reason. So just to catch up for people. Hey, don't worry. Don't worry. Seriously,
that's mad.
The ease with which anybody can get hold of it today is so great. That the argument that legalising it would make it easier to access doesn't hold water.
Don't you think the reason that it's so readily available that someone's getting paid off somewhere?
Yes. Exactly that.
Like, it's literally... So I'm feeling like if you are making it more legal and it's in front of people... then these people are not getting paid off anymore.
Correct.
And it becomes less readily available.
I'm
sick of it.
Yes. Clearly.
It's more readily... Do you know what? If I want to go and smoke a joint, I have to look for days. If I want to go and hit a line... I could do that in 10 minutes.
And that's the context in which this contribution from The Economist has been made. It's reflecting the reality that you describe. I don't know that reality, but you do. Henry did. The world in which it is easier to get hold of than I don't know, probably easier to find than a good plumber. The world that The Economist is legislating for is that world. And it's mad, isn't it, that the line in the article that says that voters and politicians are completely unmoved by this. It doesn't matter how much logic you mount up on one side of the battlefield, it will never land a punch on people on the other side. Which is extraordinary, really. And I wonder if Henry's explanation of where drug prohibition comes from has its roots in all those things that are suddenly becoming very fashionable again, all of which can be loosely described as epic bloody racism. Explain why it's so entrenched within our societies, this antipathy towards, suspicion of, negativity about legalization. It'd be absolutely negative about, you can be negative about alcohol, but not believing that it should be criminalised overnight. Thank you, Bob. Stay safe, all right, and look after yourself. Pam's in Stowmarket. Pam, what made you pick up the phone?
A long-suffering mother of an addict who has a serious mental health condition as well.
Okay.
And may or may not be self-medicating. He's been on and off drugs, and at the moment he's so seriously on at 45 years of age.
Right.
He now believes there's no alternative. This is it. And it's a miracle that he hasn't gone to prison. I get to the point where I wish he had, but I'm not very sure that prison would fix anything.
No.
Seems to have as many drugs in prison as out of prison.
Yes.
He has been at my vast expense. That's another gripe I've got against this system. Why, oh, why is it left to people to fork out 14,000, 10,000 quid every time they go to rehab? If they walk out on the very first day, you've still lost your money. That's another thing that needs looking at.
Yeah.
There is so much, including our beloved so-called rehabilitation services, which are available from 10 to 4. Those are definitely drug addicts' hours, you know? They pay lip service the minute somebody screws up and doesn't attend for an appointment. They are kicked out. And once they're kicked out, my understanding is, I can't verify it, but I understand it from volunteers who I know who've worked in these services, they are marked as success or... Yeah,
this is absolutely fascinating, and I'm sorry that you're so well qualified to contribute in this way, Pam.
I bet
you are. but the a lot of what you describe, the sort of chaotic infrastructure, if we could praise it as that, is probably a consequence of the illegality of the drug, right? Or not?
Probably. It's also very, very, very little mention politically of it. It's swept under the carpet. Someone gave him some stats yesterday, which I'm not good at recalling figures, being in my 80s. And I have suffered this scenario since he was first diagnosed with schizophrenia 20-odd years ago.
Gosh.
And it is a miracle that I am still sane, let alone alive. And I have fallen over backwards to help this poor man, in the end. He's not a kid anymore.
Well, he is in a way.
In a way. You're so right, because your brain is affected. Your brain is affected anyway by the serious mental illness he had.
Yeah.
But it's affected equally by continually abuse of drugs. He's been on and off drugs, but it never, ever lasts. And one of the reasons it probably never lasts is because the idea of care in the community for people who have serious drug,
mental health issues.
It's a joke. It's an absolute joke. Nobody has even been to his house to see what
you're on your own.
Lived in.
You're on your own.
On your own as families. You are utterly
until you commit a crime of sufficient severity for the authorities to actually get involved. So I'm going to. We haven't clarified this, but I presume you're in favour of legalisation of some sort.
I would call it decriminalisation, yes, if that keeps people happy. If that's going to help the Daily Mail suffer it.
But, yes, you know, well, nothing will help the Daily Mail, Pam. No, they're beyond help, I think. But I know, you know, why you say what you say.
They're beyond help, Jane. Well, we've got all the others, haven't we?
So many of the problems you describe would diminish. They may not disappear, but they would diminish.
Exactly. The police are wasting all of their time chasing God knows what they're doing. I mean, you know, a friend of mine said to a policeman, why don't you follow them? Why don't you follow my daughter? And then you can arrest them. No, that hasn't happened. Why it hasn't happened? It's somewhat of a mystery. Why, you always hear, oh, they're waiting to get Mr. Big. Well, when did you last hear of them getting a Mr. Big?
I mean,
it happens very occasionally, but not very often, not enough to explain the vast quantities of drugs that are in every single nook and cranny of this land. Do not, people of my age group have no clue. I have no idea. They live in a, you know, nicely improving position due to their houses having gone up and up.
Yes.
I'm in that position too. You know, I could be very self-satisfied and not know about it and not want to know about it. But until someone like you, and I'm very, very impressed that you've done this, finally, because, James, if you don't do it, God knows who will do it. And please don't let it die. Please don't let it
Well, I'll put it on my list of things that we circle back to whenever we get the opportunity. I really will. And you know, Zach Polanski's name is popping up a lot at the moment. And, you know, it may be that it turns out that people are putting a little bit more hope on him than he merits or deserves. I don't know. I'm withholding judgment entirely, but he has a policy that does speak almost directly to the sort of legalization, or if you prefer decrim, they're not quite the same thing, but that speaks to the sort of legalization that you and Henry and Bob and almost everybody really, except Chris, who understandably 7 months clean is, balking at the notion of it being more easily available, not necessarily more readily available. It's there. It's in the discourse, and it probably won't go away anytime soon. Pam, I said it already, but I'll say it again. I'm really sorry that you were in such a position to make such a helpful and powerful contribution to the programme, and I wish you and your boy the very, very best. I really do. And I promise I will keep the conversation alive whenever I can. Simon Marks is with us shortly in order to look. I mean, what do I say? How do I introduce him? Okay, here's one. Guess what Donald Trump is doing now to the actual White House?
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why this staggering level of incompetence?
Straight to the point.
This is the economics of the madhouse from this government.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
But she does seem to struggle with her sums.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Can your phone drown out irritating noises in your videos? Can anybody hear me over this? Luckily, Audio Eraser on the Galaxy S25 Ultra gets rid of background noises in seconds. Can your phone do that? Galaxy can. Get 15% off Galaxy S25 Ultra with code S15.
Buy from Samsung.com by the 21st of October 2025. Use code at checkout. Voucher code can't be combined with any other offer. Samsung account login and network connection required.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 991234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Business healthcare. Sounds pricey.
At Benenden Health, it's less than £16 per employee per month, which
will go up when people use it.
Actually, no. We don't do price hikes each time our services are used. Just
medical questionnaires for everyone.
No. And it's quick and easy to join.
Sounds great. I'm in.
Benenden Health. Healthcare done different. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Selected surgical procedures. Immediate access for businesses. Wait periods apply for personal membership. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
Step aboard the legend of the Titanic, London's award-winning exhibition devoted to the world's most famous ocean liner at Dock X Canada Water. Walk her decks, explore her cabins, discover her secrets. With 360-degree projections, VR, an interactive metaverse, artifacts, and more. Book your tickets today at legendoftitanic.com.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
James O'Brien on LBC.
11:52, is he turning it into the Gold House, asks Paul, which is, I mean, not with beyond the realms of possibility, is it? But let's start with the building, shall we, Simon Marks?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have to say, it takes quite a lot now to surprise me and shock me. But I was heading home last night and I saw the first White House pool report, which in this wonderfully calm language informed us that part of the East Wing of the White House is being torn down today. Some reporters have spotted the construction from a park near the Treasury Department this afternoon. And I thought that cannot possibly be right. You don't just go and tear down part of the East Wing of the White House. And then these pictures started emerging of the wrecking crew having been brought in without any warning by the President of the United States, without any permission, without any planning process that is completed, and there should be one because the National Capital Planning Commission almost certainly has to weigh in. It's a national historic landmark. And to kind of put this into context, my office, James, as you know, is right on the other side of the street from the White House. I recently thought, well, there's one room in there. I'd like to move a wall by about 4 feet. I'd like to slightly expand one of the offices. I would spend the rest of my life trying to secure a permit from DC to carry out that minimal amount of work. He has just completely laid waste to part of the East Wing, you know, the wing that since 1902 has been the preserve of first ladies. Of course, Melania doesn't use it because she's never in the White House. And this is all part of the process of building the ballroom that he said was not going to require any of the White House to be torn down. Indeed, his own press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, said earlier this year, nothing is going to be torn down. And they've just sent the wrecking crew in. And the White House says this is all pearl clutching. Every president gets the chance to modernize the building. You know, Richard Nixon put a bowling alley in. The White House press room is built above FDR's old swimming pool. But nobody does this stuff without permission. And this is deliberate. This is designed once again to say to the American public and the world, I can do whatever I want. There are no guardrails that I'm going to honor or observe that are going to stop me.
So, I mean, he may well want a ballroom, or he may just be demonstrating, as you say, that he is beholden to no rule, regulation, tradition, convention, or requirement.
Well, I think it's both. He wants the ballroom, and he constantly falsely claims that presidents for decades have wondered why the White House doesn't have a 90,000 square foot ballroom. This notion was never mooted before
he arrived.
He's
trying to turn it into Mar-a-Lago.
And that's exactly what he's doing. Right. So, and this ballroom, by the way, $250 million project, is being financed by donors whose identities we do not know. What kind of payback they're getting for their generosity, we do not know. And these are many of the same donors who have already paid for the paving of the White House Rose Garden, which he has turned into what he's referring to as the Rose Garden Club. You know, Jackie Kennedy's old famous Rose Garden.
Yeah.
Paved over. They brought the umbrellas up from Mar-a-Lago. He pipes music in off playlists that he controls in the Oval Office.
So vulgar.
Today, he's hosting a lunch in the Rose Garden Club and then a dinner in the Rose Garden Club. And
you've got to wonder
who all these people are. I mean, the lunch is for Republican lawmakers, so we know who's attending that. We don't know who's yet attending the dinner tonight.
We know how much he charges at Mar-a-Lago.
Exactly.
So this conflation of public good
and personal money is now complete.
You mentioned Caroline Leavitt, and I don't need you to comment on this. I just need you to confirm that it's true, because a lot of my listeners won't believe that it is. Asked recently who decided upon Budapest as the location for the imminent meeting between Trump and Vladimir Putin. The White House communications director replied to journalists, "Your mom did."
Yes, well, she did say that. I mean, there have been more egregious examples of that when Rand Paul, the Libertarian Republican senator from Kentucky, started raising questions about whether the Trump administration had any legal justification for blowing alleged speedboats of Colombian drug, Venezuelan drug traffickers out of the waters of the Caribbean. He raised questions about it on social media, to which J.D. Vance responded with a word I cannot use on family radio and said, I don't give a what you think of it. They're unconstrained.
I think one of the Colombian people killed almost certainly found to be an entirely blameless fisherman.
Outrage.
We're going to run out of time. To the video, this extraordinary AI-created video of Donald Trump in an aeroplane with a crown on his head, dropping, well, you tell.
Donald Trump in an aeroplane called, the plane emblazoned with the name King Trump, an AI-created video that he posted over the weekend on social media, in which he takes to the skies with the theme tune of Top Gun played over the video, and he drops payloads of human excrement on protesters below.
How many protesters were there?
In the video.
No, in the...
Oh,
in the
7 million.
How many?
7 million. According to the organizer. I mean, we're never going to know the official number.
Sure.
But the organizers say up to 7 million. It was certainly
American
millions
voters,
of
American
people.
Citizens, American...
2,600 protests worldwide, the largest mobilization we've seen yet against the Trump presidency. The White House official statement on that, who cares?
And finally, I was reading this morning, in fact, about a key Trump appointment, or a new Trump appointment, who appears to have been boasting online about his Nazi sympathies.
Yes, this is a man called Paul Ingrassia, who has been selected by President Trump to head the Office of the Special Counsel, which in the past has been an independent anti-corruption agency, although clearly Donald Trump wants him to be there in order to pursue retribution against his enemies, like John Bolton, we've already seen, and James Comey, the former head of the FBI. It's been revealed by Politico that Mr. Ingrassia used a text chat to tell fellow Republicans that he has a Nazi streak in him from time to time. I will admit to it, he says. He also believes that the national holiday every year celebrating the life of Martin Luther King should be tossed into the seventh circle of hell where it belongs. Three Republican senators so far have indicated that they are not going to vote in favor of his confirmation. His hearing is supposed to happen on Thursday.
Backbone.
So the leaders of the Republicans, small amount, couple of vertebrae, but the leader of the Republicans in the Senate is asking Trump to withdraw the nomination. Let's see what happens after that lunch in the Rose Garden Club today. Maybe he will finally concede that he's made a mistake, or maybe he'll double down and see if he can get enough votes to have J.D. Vance break the tiebreaker.
How many does he need? How many people need to object?
He's lost three already, so he would now be in a position where J.D. Vance would have to cast the tiebreaker. He can't afford to lose more than that.
So one more and it's game over. In the meantime, and if Vance casts the tiebreaker, you have someone appointed to this position who is quite open about their Nazi sympathies.
At a time when, you know, group chats of young Republicans also show that they have been very open about their admiration for Hitler, for the gas chambers, their hostility to LGBTQ Americans. You know, young Republicans should not, said J.D. Vance, be penalized for engaging in youthful activities, but many of these people were above the age of 30.
Yes. I'll tell you what, though. At least he's never moved a bust of Winston Churchill into a different room. Eh?
Well, he's brought it back.
There you go. So technically, I suppose he has. It's 12 noon.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, Boris Johnson's denied there was a failure to plan for school closures in England at the start of the pandemic. The former Prime Minister's told the UK COVID-19 inquiry that young people paid a huge price to protect others. Mr. Johnson has described school closures as a nightmare, but unavoidable at the time. He's also admitted the way exam grades were calculated was well-intentioned, but clearly failed.
It was not a good system. We should not have put it through. We should have spotted it faster. I think that your criticisms are valid. All I would say is that, you try coming up with a system to give a fair exam result for people when they can't sit exams. It's not easy. Okay?
Prince Andrew is under renewed pressure over his living arrangements at a mansion on the Windsor estate. It's emerged he's paid only a peppercorn rent on the property for the last 20 years, after paying £1 million for the lease in 2003. Andrew, who denies wrongdoing, is facing fresh allegations in Virginia Giuffre's posthumous memoir. The business secretary, Peter Kyle, was asked about Royal Lodge when he spoke to LBC earlier.
On that particular matter, that's a lease with the Crown Estate, and those are matters for the King. They're not matters for government or myself. But let me be really clear, you know, because we are talking about a situation, and we're talking on the day when the memoirs of Virginia Giuffre are released. Once again, the spotlight is on the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. Let's stay focused on that. And
two more men have been arrested in connection with the death of the former Lost Prophets frontman Ian Watkins. The 48-year-old, who was serving a 29-year jail term for child sex offences, died after an attack at HMP Wakefield earlier this month. Another two men, aged 25 and 43, have already been charged with murder. Ministers say they have a plan to bring down borrowing after the deficit grew by another £20 billion last month. It was the highest government borrowing figure for a September in 5 years. The figure was driven by rising debt interest costs, pay rises for public sector workers and inflation. And forecasters have issued yellow warnings for wind and rain across large parts of England and Wales. The Met Office alerts cover southern, central and eastern areas on Thursday. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading up 19 points at 94.22. The pound buys $1.33 and a €1.15. LBC weather, sunny spells and scattered showers for many places today. The rain heaviest and most frequent in the northwest, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Train to Three Bridges for two adults, one skeleton and one fairy werewolf, as you do.
Just one pumpkin each, kids. Charlie, not that one, mate. It's nearly as big as you.
Back on the train with two little monsters and a couple of pumpkins. Now off home to spend a good 3 hours carving. Download the Thameslink Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Four is the time. I mentioned to you yesterday how shocked I was at how little pickup there had been for some truly hideous comments by a Conservative MP called Katie Lamb, not just in the media but also on the broader political landscape. It has got better. Liberal Democrats have written to the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, urging her to condemn the comments by one of her MPs, essentially calling for large numbers of legally settled families to be deported in order to increase cultural coherence. I'll leave you to speculate on what that means. I think the Liberal Democrat MP Will Forster was behind that letter, and some media pick up as well. But these are the moments. So we sit here with Simon chronicling the abject corruption of Donald Trump, knocking down bits of the actual White House to build a massive ballroom in which he will almost certainly... into which he will almost certainly invite people in return for giving him large sums of money. If you were able to place a bet on him having a go, at the very least, on staying in the White House beyond the end of his second term, then I'm not sure you'd get particularly good odds at the moment. But we talk about someone with expressed Nazi sympathies being in line for a senior appointment. We talk about junior Republicans populating their WhatsApp chats with jokes about gas chambers, admiration for Adolf Hitler. You think we're exaggerating when we start saying things like, this is all looking a little bit like 1930s Germany, or this is all looking a little bit fascistic, this is all looking a little bit far right. But the dial gets turned, and I know I wang on about the boiled frog, but it's the perfect analogy, even if it's not biologically sound. You turn the dial incrementally, so that when you say something that would have been outrageous three notches down, it's no longer outrageous. What Katie Lamb said at the weekend was worse than a lot of the things that Enoch Powell said. And Ted Heath threw him out of the Tory party before his feet could touch the ground. Kemi Badenoch has said nothing about these hideous comments, and nor, so far as I am aware, has Keir Starmer. And that's what a boiled frog looks like. So if you're sitting there wondering whether or not this country could ever go the way of the United States with Nazis being promoted to serious positions or senior positions, and Nazis being feted and lauded, championed in WhatsApp groups between prominent youthful or younger, some of them, as Simon said, are over 30, members of the Republican Party, then this is how it happens. It gets dialed up. Sometimes you have very crass sort of people stepping on, like Robert Jenrick doing it, talking about white faces, how they're the only ones he really likes to see. But other times you have a slightly more mealy-mouthed approach, but nevertheless the dial still ticks up. Talk about cultural coherence. Make sure the UK is more culturally coherent by deporting legally settled families. That's how it happened. That would have been outrageous 5 years ago. And it's very, very unpopular now, for the record. But, you know, lots of things that were very, very unpopular before the full weight of the far right and their media clientele or got stuck into things end up becoming popular. 12:08 is the time. Complete change of pace now. This is a bit of a greatest hits, isn't it, this week? So we had a little look at 4x4s yesterday, and it wasn't an entirely successful conversation. I don't know whether you picked up on that, but do you know why it wasn't as much fun as it used to be when I was putting the boot into 4x4s? Because I wasn't attacking the owners anymore. And that, sadly, is what we are. We are a gladiatorial species. We like watching a little bit of blood on the carpet, even if it's done in jest and with the tongue in cheek. It doesn't work as much when you're merely attacking the cars. You've got to be attacking the people in them. I think I used to do a thing about women with faces like cat's bottoms, you know, like that. They were the ones most likely to be driving, and that would wind people up, and they'd ring in, and we'd have a shout at each other, and it was largely, I hope, good-natured or in jest, but it was really funny when it wasn't. I once got called, what was I called? A corpse-eating psychopath. Can anyone remember? Was it a corpse-eating psychopath? I've got a feeling there was another word in the sentence. A something corpse-eating psychopath. Or was it just a corpse-eating psychopath? And that's what happens. Those moments are what happen when you make it personal. You see, that was personal, and it's more fun. Conflict is more fun when it's personal. And I don't know whether it's a little bit po-faced of me, and I keep saying post-therapy. I think it was in therapy that I sort of found it a little bit futile to be unnecessarily personal or rude about people, as opposed to what people believe or what people have done, not people themselves. But I was called a corpse-eating psychopath during a conversation about veganism. And I wasn't even particularly brutal about vegans. I mean, you've got the obvious jokes and the old, a psychopathic corpse-eater. That's a headline. You're going to click on this later, aren't you? Rat-loving vegan says James is a psychopathic corpse-eater. You can find that on the LBC app. Can we keep an eye on the traffic that now makes its way to a story that says rat-loving vegan says James is a psychopathic corpse eater? And this happened, when was it, roughly? About 3 years ago? I think we were talking about Hunt Saboteurs at the time. When was it? I've been doing this a long time. It was in 2017, feels like only yesterday. And it was during a period of time when you would describe the vegan cause as being on the march, wouldn't you? It began to pick up pace, I'd say, in the middle of the last decade, and moved upwards. If we were going to be talking about dials, the veganism dial would be turning all the time, to the point where I saw Simon Amstel's brilliant, brilliant film about a world in which veganism, or at least vegetarianism, has become law, and everybody lies and pretends. It'll be a bit like Brexit. Everybody pretends that they never ate meat. Give it another few years, and everybody will pretend that that they didn't vote for Brexit. And I watched that film, the name of which very temporarily eludes me. I watched that film, and I honestly thought, well, I'm not giving it up yet, but I think that I will be alive when it does actually become almost anathema to eat meat. I don't know whether it will be criminalized ever. I mean, you can't really have a conversation about legalizing cocaine and then have a conversation about criminalizing meat. But I just think it will become anathema. And I watched my children and their relationship with meat and their peer group's relationship with meat. And the march of veganism and vegetarianism seemed to me to be unstoppable. As a flesh-eating psychopath, it was, I felt, an unstoppable march. And it has stopped. If not completely, then the acceleration, the rate of acceleration, the speed even, the velocity has almost completely disappeared. Culminating this week in a relatively small story, but nonetheless a significant one, because I think that it's really moved on in the last couple of years. 2023, Cambridge University Student Union voted to transition the entire university to an all-vegan menu in university cafes and canteens. And this was supported by 72% of voting members. I didn't understand that. I mean, I remember student politics vaguely. I never really got involved in it. I'll tell you who was heavily involved in student politics when I was a kid. Martin Lewis. Absolute genius campaigner. I mean, you'd expect it, really, wouldn't you, from the money-saving expert? But he had all the bases covered. I just used to sort of wander into college about once or twice a week to play snooker, and they'd all be putting up posters and campaign. So it may well be that you just load the room with everybody who's going to stick their hand in there. I think I got voted president of the Drama Society by doing that once, but then I failed the year, so I couldn't take up the role the year afterwards. The point I'm making is I don't imagine that 72% of students at Cambridge University are vegan. But they've now reversed the decision, deciding that, and this is the bit I love, there are more important issues out there. Carnage, Simon's film was called, set in 2067. It looks back at a time when human beings ate other animals. And for the young people in 2067, the idea that their grandparents could have been complicit in a bloodbath of unnecessary suffering is wholly unimaginable. It's a brilliant film. He's a supremely talented man, as you know. It's a brilliant film, and I came out of it persuaded that it was plausible, that we were, as a population, on a path towards a place where the idea of eating meat was repellent, and young people couldn't believe that old people used to do it. I genuinely believed that. I wasn't ready to do it myself, but for health reasons, I cut down on red meat, and I found myself flirting with the idea of going further and thinking that I would. I had two vegetarians at home who are not vegetarians anymore, and an awful lot of people I know in this space have... What's the word then? Because I'm not going to do what I did yesterday and completely avoid getting personal about it. But I don't want to be unnecessarily offensive. I think if people can call me a corpse-eating psychopath, there's a little bit of room for me to be mildly offensive in return. But what's the word for it? Bailed? They've bailed. I don't like seeing the error of their ways. I don't want to gloat unduly. But what I want to know is why. Why has what felt like an unstoppable march towards much, much more vegetarianism and indeed veganism? And for me, with veganism, it's the honey that gets me. It's the idea that you shouldn't eat honey because it exploits bees that I find almost impenetrable. Like, I understand the logic and indeed the compassion for bees that lies behind it. But things like that that just nudged it into the realms of the ridiculous for me. But not eating beef, not eating sentient creatures has an ineluctable logic to it. But things seem to have gone backwards. Why? Why is veganism in retreat? 0345 6060973. You can do the overview if you want, but I'd really like to know why you started eating meat again, or dialed down your veganism to vegetarianism, perhaps, or started eating fish. Just why? I really want the what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, the social impact, like what it is about society, changes within society, that explains why something that felt unstoppable, I would say 3 or 4 years ago, that's why I thought that the corpse-eating psychopath comments were much more recent than they actually were. Something that felt unstoppable long after lockdown appears not just to have stopped, but to have moved into reverse. Shall we go with lapsed? Scott in Brentford suggests lapsed. Lapsed vegans, lapsed vegetarians, gives it an agreeably cultish or religious connotation. And I mean, one of the things I did work out when I was examining all the areas in which I felt I had become unnecessarily offensive was that a lot of abuse of vegetarians came from a place of shame and guilt. So you kind of knew that you shouldn't be eating animals. And therefore, the people who had the backbone to actually, and the self-discipline to actually make that decision and not eat animals had to be pilloried and mocked because they made the rest of us feel bad about our own decisions. You've got to be quite open and honest with yourself to recognize that. A lot of people won't recognize that, but it is true. It is the reason why vegetarians come in for it. I mean, there's the smugness, but if you're not a smug vegetarian and you're still getting abuse, it's because people are a little bit guilty and ashamed of the fact that you have actually followed through with what they know to be the right course of action. I'm not even sure that's true anymore. I mean, is it a massive victory by Big Meat? Or whatever you want to call it. That would be my darts name, I think. Is it a massive victory by the meat lobby? Have they actually successfully turned around the national narrative? Is it about something not immediately obvious? Why have young people essentially dialed down their commitment to this cause? Central question is, why has the apparently unstoppable march of veganism been halted and possibly reversed? So you can answer it in one or two ways. You can either go for the personal, which is why you have lapsed, or you can go for the political, which is why the numbers are diminishing and decreasing. Also, I don't know if you've noticed this, but the aisle in the supermarket, at one point, you'd have like a whole aisle of vegan foods. You went from, it was only ever Linda McCartney, and then it was bloody everywhere. Vegan this, vegan that, vegan pizza, vegan this. And then it sort of dropped off a cliff again. So obviously people weren't buying it. That's ultra-processed food, and that's not very good for you whether it's vegan or not. But the personal and the political, why have you knocked it on the head? 03456060973. And why has the national mood apparently shifted so much on this specific issue? It's 12:19.
This is LBC.
There's some naughty folks out there in cyberspace, and it can be tough to tell a legit deal from a dodgy one. That's why you need Bitdefender, your very own digital heavyweight, working silently behind the scenes to keep you and your devices safe. Whatever threats the web throws at you. Trusted by the experts, used by the pros.
Bitdefender, a global leader in cybersecurity. Trusted, always.
Verify now at bitdefender.com.
Your daily life often goes like this. With Air France, choose instead. Until the 21st of October, put your daily life on hold. Take advantage of Air France moments and book your flight to St. Martin from £679 flying from London Heathrow via Paris. Return including tax. Elegance is a journey. Air France. To book and for terms and conditions, visit airfrance.co.uk.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
21 minutes after 12. It's not just Cambridge University. A study has shown that there has been a distinct decline. This is a study by a consumer insights platform, no less, in the number of people identifying as vegan. Sales of plant-based alternatives have fallen by about 21% in the year to June of last year, compared to just 2 years before. Some companies have stopped stocking specific vegan products. Even Greggs has axed some of its vegan products. So has Quorn, which used to be a byword for eschewing meat, didn't it? And I just want to know why. Google searches show that terms like veganism, vegan diet, even vegan recipes peaked in late 2019, early 2020. And it's an odd thing to say, but I like being wrong because it keeps me honest and it keeps me young. And I was telling you the truth when I said I felt that the direction of traffic was unstoppable and that we would reach a point in my lifetime where meat had been rendered sort of carne non grata, almost. And we haven't, and it doesn't look like we ever will. And I wonder why you think that is. Especially if you're still committed to the cause and you have a, if you like, a ringside view of why other people have fallen by the wayside. Sarah is in Amersham. Sarah, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello.
Big fan. Thrilled to talk to you.
Thank you.
I just felt like this spoke to me quite a lot. I was vegan for 12 years. And a lot of my career actually centered around being vegan. And it was just a very big part of my life. But I felt very tired over the last couple of years. I was really struggling. And so my partner suggested to maybe bring back in some eggs.
How did they suggest that? Go talk me through the tactics, because that's tricky. That's really sensitive stuff.
Yes, he did it very slowly, very considerably. not vegan or even vegetarian himself.
Sure.
Had to very much adjust to me not having meat in the house. I love to cook, so I cooked, and to be fair, he was like, oh, I can see vegan food's not boring.
Oh, for sure. I'd never suggest that, but I'm interested in how did he just sort of say, because you're obviously mentioning, understandably, how exhausted you are. And and he says, have you thought, I don't even know what the first line would be. Can you remember what the first line, sounds like the last hour of the conversation. Can you remember what the first line was?
I remember vaguely. It was really chronic. Yeah. I was having to come home from work on my lunch breaks to have a nap. It was really debilitating. And he just looked at me and leaned over and took my hand and was like, I think there's something that we've tried a lot of things, and I think there's something that we need to look at that you've not been looking at. And I think that it might be time to consider making a change to just see if it works. And would you be willing to think about that? Because it's getting to a point where it's a bit desperate to be living
like this. Did you think he was talking about your love life, or did you realise that he was talking about your diet?
I think that he was taking our love life into his own hands, making the suggestion.
He sounds lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a good one. But he was very compassionate and was coming at it from a place of really understanding at that point what I'd been doing. And so he was just very gentle and said, let's get some eggs from a small holding nearby. And so you can see the happy chickens. And so that's still what we do. And let's try some fish, because I'd said that I had always still kind of missed fish. And it took me quite a long time, actually, of introducing it back for my brain not to be sort of panicking at the texture. It was really hard. It was really, really hard. It's insane how your brain changes. The smell of bacon used to smell so good, and now I can't stand it.
Gosh.
Makes me really feel quite sick. So I just still don't think we're going to be in a very meaty household ever. I think he's had to come to terms with that and go...
No, but you've turned a fairly hefty corner, and it did work. I mean, I'm presuming you wouldn't be ringing me unless you felt your energy levels increase almost immediately.
Yes, yeah, and even now, we have fish about once a week, something like that, and the day after, we always notice a really big change in my energy levels and how I feel, and my thinking feels clearer. A colleague as well actually recommended an article that they'd seen about brain fog and eggs helping with that. And I think there's lots of core nutrients that, although I was supplementing and I was very careful, I just probably wasn't quite getting everything all the time, because you have to be so thoughtful and so considered to be able to really hit everything all the time, I think.
I think one of the things we sometimes miss during these conversations is that everybody's different. So there'll be vegetarians or vegans listening 100%. To this who've got, like Duracell bunnies. They've got more energy than the national grid, but they're not you.
Yes, there's a really important definition about veganism. I think that Amelia Lees has it in her book, How to Think Like a Vegan, I think.
Okay.
She's got it in there. About veganism being what you can reasonably do. So if you live somewhere where it's food desert and you can't get things and you have to use bits of things, it's about doing the most you can do to reasonably reduce harm. And so I still kind of consider myself a little bit like that, whilst also I would no longer describe myself as a vegan, absolutely.
But it doesn't matter, because you're still doing your best, living by your principles in the healthiest way possible. Do you have a view, because you mentioned you used to work in the field, possibly you still do. Maybe you're not allowed to tell any of your colleagues that you've just broken cover on national radio. But the do you have a bigger picture view as well, like rather than an individual energy-related case? Why the national picture has changed? The national picture seems to be diminished.
I used to do recruitment specifically for people with those the vegan principles.
Wow.
And we worked across different, whether it was tech, so biotech or food. I did quite a lot in food, actually. All kinds of, sometimes there was like chemical, like drugs testing, animal-free drug testing, all kinds of different industries.
Okay.
And so I used to go to conferences that were very heavily focused around veganism and things like that for my work.
Yeah.
And I shifted out of that again about 3 years ago, maybe, because honestly, it was also just a bit too hard to look at it, and the climate aspect of things not being great and Trump getting back in. I was a bit of a turning point for me, I think, with deciding I can't look at this every day for my work. It's a bit too overwhelming.
Yeah, welcome to my world.
You don't know how you do it, James. I'm sure that there'll be ex-colleagues or people I worked with that maybe hear this and go, oh, she's not vegan anymore.
Right, except as you say, I mean, you know, it's obviously it can be a very strict description, but doing whatever within the context of your principles, living the healthiest life you can, is clearly what you are doing. What a lovely call, and what a lovely boyfriend as well. Thank you, Sarah. And that's a perfect start to this conversation, isn't it? Because it doesn't involve any allegations of being a corpse-eating psychopath. Speaking of animals and my love for them, if you don't follow me on the only social media platform I'm really on these days, then you probably don't know about the adventure I had this weekend with my next-door neighbour's cat. Yeah. Massive adventure. I mean, this is arguably one of the... What's the word? I don't want to say manly. That would be the wrong word to use. Heroic's good, Keith, thank you. It was, I mean, truly heroic behaviour on my part, but also quite... No, it has to explain the sort of physical side of it. It was the kind of thing that you might see in a Diet Coke advert. There we go. So that's a way of saying manly without saying manly, isn't it? I did something at the weekend with my neighbour's cat that features the sort of conduct and imagery that you would associate with that rich seam of Diet Coke adverts from a few years ago, where very muscular men would be operating pneumatic drills or something like that. I wonder if you could possibly... don't cheat on this. I wonder if you could possibly work out what it was that I did with my next-door neighbour's cat that would not have looked out of place in a 1980s Diet Coke advert. Here's Thomas Watts with your headlines.
Boris Johnson has denied his government failed to plan for school closures in England during the pandemic. The former Prime Minister has been giving evidence to the UK COVID-19 inquiry about its impact on children and young people. Prince Andrew and the government are facing further pressure over his royal titles and living arrangements. It's emerged he's paid only a peppercorn rent on his 30-room mansion on the Windsor estate for the last 20 years. Rising debt interest costs, pay rises and inflation all helped to push up the deficit last month. Government borrowing rose to £20.2 billion. That's the highest September figure in 5 years. LBC weather. Sunny spells and scattered showers for many places. The rain heaviest and most frequent in northwestern parts of the UK. A high of 16 degrees.
This is LBC.
A Southern train is a place where you can have more me time. A chance to skip traffic and glide to wherever you need to be. With headspace to focus on more important matters. Like if that cloud is a starfish or sunflower. Fast journeys without the rush with great deals at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
This year, Amazon are increasing the electric delivery vehicles we use across Europe to 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of. Where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts. And where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden.
Can they have their ball back, please?
We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
12:33 is the time. So we had some new floorboards put in last week. And the old floorboard, the fellow we bought the house off had, it used to be a doctor's surgery. And the lino on the floor in this room appears to have been stuck down using bitumen. So there was no prospect whatsoever of getting the lino off and then sanding the floorboards that were underneath. So we got new floor. Luckily, the fella we know was taking floorboards out of another house because they didn't want them anymore. So anyway, that's all very boring. But it meant that the whole floor in that room got lifted up, right? And then they started putting down the floorboards. Done a beautiful job, and they finished it on Tuesday of last week. So all signed, sealed, and delivered. Beautiful finish on it, polished up the floorboards, varnished them or whatever it is, oiled them, and it looked gorgeous. Fast forward to Saturday, and next door came round to tell us that their cat was missing, and wondering whether we'd seen it. And we obviously said that we hadn't. But Mrs. O'Brien, being a much better neighbour than me, went on a bit of a tour and checked the garage and the shed and all that kind of thing. And we were making sure it wasn't like I've got a daughter away at university. It hadn't got shut in her room or gone under the bed or anything like that. And we hadn't. And we were going out for Sunday lunch with my mother-in-law. And my wife said, What if she's under the floorboards? And I said, don't be ridiculous. The amount of noise they made while they were doing that job, so hammering, sawing, sanding, there is no earthly way, even if a cat had crawled into the spaces under the floorboards that had already been put down when they went home for the day before returning tomorrow to put down more floorboards, the amount of noise, the cat would come out of there like a bat out of hell. And I may even have sounded a little bit dismissive when I said something like, there is no way there is a cat under our floorboards, so we come back from lunch and she's obviously got a bit of a bee in her bonnet and calls me into the relevant room, closes the door behind me, calls the cat's name, and that there is a meowing sound coming from under the floor. Quite a plaintive meowing sound. It wasn't a sort of full-throated meow. It was more of a meow, meow. And we've got three cats, right? So my first thought, I had two thoughts initially. My first thought was, oh, Lord, I've heard that. I just presumed it was one of our cats because it's the room that I play video games in. And my second thought was, how do we know it isn't one of our cats, even though it sounds like it's coming from beneath the floorboards? We could have a ventriloquist cat without knowing it, or it could just be an accident of whatever you call it. a sonic accident, a sonic coincidence. So I fed the three cats because it was feeding time, and I shut the door on the room that we feed the cats in, which is far enough away from the room under discussion to ensure that any meowing that we heard would not be coming from our own cats hiding around the corner or anything like that. We go back in, close the door again, call the cat's name. It's not my place to tell you the name of next door's cat. It's there. It's there. It's their privacy. And there it is again, a bit louder, this, and it's moved a bit. So then we have a bit of a dilemma, because my view is we don't necessarily tell them until we've tried to get the cat out. It was a time in my life where I might have contemplated the idea of just ignoring it and hoping it would go away, but that would have been disgusting. By which I mean I hope the cat, give it another couple of days to see if the cat would escape. But then we calculated it was going back to Tuesday, and I don't know how long a cat... We had a cat once that got stuck in a room for about 10 days while we were away, and the person that we'd paid to come in and look after the cat and feed them just kept filling up the bowl, even though it hadn't been emptied, so that by the time we got home, it was a child, so it's not a big deal. And then I thought, I'm gonna have to get my crowbar. I don't think I've ever used my crowbar. Do you own anything that you have bought, probably as a chap, rather than a chapess, just in case? I've used my drain rods. I've actually used my drain rods. They're fantastic. But I don't think I've ever actually used my crowbar. If I've used my crowbar, I've used it for something that I could easily have done with a robust screwdriver. But I went to get my crowbar. And Mrs. O'Brien at this point had gone next door to tell the neighbours, against my better judgement, because I thought we'd just present them with the good news rather than traumatise them by introducing them to the area of incarceration. And they come round, and they're understandably quite emotional. And I'm on the floor with a screwdriver, a hammer, and a crowbar. And I chip around the edge of the wood, and I get a bit of purchase on it. And it's hard because they've sealed the floorboard, so it's glue in the little gaps where the sawdust is. I think they mix sawdust with glue to make a sort of binding agent that goes between. So I'm having to chip away at all of that. I get a little bit in, and I've given up on the floorboard, right? By this point, I've said to myself, we're going to have to get one new floorboard. There's no way I'm going to be able to get this out completely intact. Can't hear any meowing at this point. I'm smacking away at the old floorboard. Hammer, chisel, screwdriver, hammer, chisel. I get a little bit of purchase on it. And they're all watching. And I'm thinking, can you not watch? Can you leave? Can you just... Well, this is why I didn't want you to go and tell them, because what if I can't do it? And we're going to have to wait until the bloke who installed the floor comes around tomorrow, and they're going to spend the whole night in on tenterhooks. What if I can't do it? I am a radio presenter. I am not a man who uses crowbars on a regular basis, although that could be changing. And I get a little bit of purchase on it, and it doesn't come, and feels probably in my own head a lot longer than it was actually taking in real life. I feel it begin to give, and a bit of the thing splinters, but I can get the crowbar in the bit that's splintered and pull the next bit up, and then I get it up, the floorboard matron. And at that point, a whole new panic kicks in, which would be, what if it can't get to the hole? I couldn't really remember what it had looked like under the floorboards. What if I can't get to the hole? The cat can't get to the hole that I've made. Are we going to have to take all the floorboards up one by one? In which case, we're definitely going to have to wait for the fellas to come back, because I'd quite like some of these floor, or ideally all of these floorboards, to be reusable rather than the one I've just wrenched up from the floor, which is in three different pieces. And so I, at this point, retire to the kitchen for a glass of lemonade, and literally, within 2 minutes, I hear these muted whoops from the beep, 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 and the cat has crawled out through the hole. And let joy be unconfined. And I have, like on my book tours and stuff like that, I've been looked at on occasion with something akin to adoration. You know, in the early days of my marriage as well, and when my children were young, and my producer and Keith regularly look at me with, you know, With adoration in their eyes. But on this occasion, all three of them, my own wife and the neighbours, just looked at me as if I was the most, as if I'd just achieved something absolutely extraordinary. Something about a crowbar, isn't there? I think. Something about a crowbar that really just sort of adds to a person's appeal. And there it was. Up it came. And all is well. The cat didn't even appear to have lost much weight. And I think we're going to get the new floorboard glued back in tomorrow. So there you go. Nice little aside for you from the conversation about veganism. If indeed Chris in Southampton can remember what... Thank you very much, Keith. Thank you, yes. Can remember why he rang in. Chris, what made you pick up the phone?
Yeah, what year are we in at the moment? I can't remember.
Well, we're going to try and fix your phone line up in the... You sound like you're not under the floorboards, are you, Chris?
No, but I'm looking for a cat under the floorboards.
I'm going to get me the crowbar. I'm going to try and get Chris out while we talk to Christine, who's in Eastbourne. Why has veganism lost its appeal, Christine? Christina,
yeah, hi. I want to take you back to 2020, middle of the pandemic.
Yes.
I was getting very into healthy eating. I just wanted to eat healthier. I was also concerned about the planet. And obviously there is, you know, the vegan trend was very much in evidence at the time. So I had all these resources. I was feeling very inspired. I had nothing else going on in my life because I was in lockdown.
Yeah, of course.
And of course, that, you know, that was a very powerful influence. So I was vegan for about 4 years. And the human body is very resilient. I think physiologically we can cope with a lot. So I think for that reason, when a lot of people go vegan, they initially they're eating lots of fruit and vegetables. They feel great. And you know, I was very careful. I was.
But I'm going to remind you that everybody's different, because I'll get a million messages reminding me that Lewis Hamilton and David Hay and various other supreme sports people are vegan or vegetarian as well, and they cope perfectly well. But you didn't, clearly. That's where that's where you're leading us.
Yeah, exactly. I and lots of other people I know, to be fair, you know, everybody's got a different. You know, it depends on all kinds of things, doesn't it? It depends on our general health. It depends on our stress levels. And obviously the content of what we're eating, if we are even taking the right supplements and all of that. So how did it
manifest itself? Were you just tired? Did you just feel tired? Or did your hair fall out? Or, I mean, what are we talking about?
Well, for me, my menstrual cycle stopped.
Good Lord, that can't be good.
Yeah.
And you were too young for it to have been for, I mean, it was definitely diet related rather than anything else.
Yeah, no, I was late 20s when I went vegan.
That's a bit of a bombshell.
I think I kind of normalised a lot as well. Like, I got used to the brain fog, I got used to the tiredness, but in hindsight now I've added the animal products back in, I feel a lot better.
And that two for two then on a very personal experience. But what was the tension between your principles and your experiences? Because you know, some people turned to veganism with fire in their belly, didn't they, Christina? You've told a story where for you it wasn't quite the sort of religious experience. It wasn't a Damascene conversion or anything like that. But what point does the physical negative overcome the? And I put this politely, overcome the sort of, I'm going to say self-righteous. Will you let me off that? I can't think of a better word, all right? So the self-righteous positive gets overtaken by the physical negative. Righteous, not self-righteous, righteous.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose for me, it was very much about the planet, and I was very concerned. You know, the carbon footprint of meat is so much higher.
Yes.
And I suppose the tipping point for me was that Am I gonna prioritize that over my own health and my own survival? And the catch 22 we have as a human race is the body doesn't know the difference. And if a majority of us are adapted to eating an omnivorous diet, if that is the diet we are going to thrive on,
I wonder whether
you have to find a way.
Yeah, exactly. And this idea of wanting some sort of control over things during COVID, John suggests a search for being more healthy coupled with a desire for control would have led quite a few people to try it, stick with it for quite a long time, but then decide that ultimately they didn't like it or they didn't want to do it, which means that things might go back to roughly where they were before it felt like the whole world was going vegan. Some people will stick with it. I like that, Christine. I'm glad you're feeling better. Thank you. 12:46 is the time. I'm going to leave. Half a dozen lapsed vegans furious that I took up so much of the show with the tale of the cat. Or even a dozen, actually, glancing at the switchboard. But, that, I mean, come on, you're supposed to be animal lovers.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
As the rest of us struggle with our housing costs, Prince Andrew lives rent-free at Windsor. I'd drop a few titles for that, wouldn't you?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
Train to Chichester. Flasks filled, snacks packed, all ready for Maisie's first stargazing adventure.
Come on, Maisie. Follow everyone up to the top of that hill.
Oh, look, that one's the plough.
Shooting star. Wow.
Oh, made it. Last train back and feeling cosmic. And it seems we have an astronaut in the making. Download the Southern Railway app to book kids tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com. That's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe, only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary. Your daily life often goes like this. With Air France, choose instead.
Wow.
Until the 21st of October, put your daily life on hold. Take advantage of Air France moments and book your flight to Beijing from £499, flying from London Heathrow via Paris. Return including tax. Elegance is a journey. Air France. To book and for terms and conditions, visit airfrance.co.uk.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
12:49 is the time. Not all heroes wear capes, right, James? Some wield crowbars in awkward and self-conscious ways. Yep, that'd be me. I'm not alone, though. This is lovely, Chris. This is one of my favourite messages in a while. James, he writes, your cat story has made me feel so much better. I work in construction and admire your talent with what you do. I know I could never do it, but I now know from your description of your cat escapades over the weekend that you would never be able to do my job either. Thank you. That's nice, Chris. There you go. Live and let live. And this from Steve. As a joiner for over 40 years, I've done loads of flooring. I always ask tenants to keep cats out of the room whilst I'm working because they're just too inquisitive. Maybe a couple more cat messages, but in the meantime, back to the veganism. Gary's in Tooting. Gary, what made you pick up the phone?
Well, I wanted to contrast two different experiences that I had because 40 years ago, I decided to give up meat and fish, become vegetarian, because I just didn't want to be part of that. And it opened all these doors. I remember eating alfalfa salad in Cranks. I remember going to a vegetarian restaurant on the Left Bank in Paris. And all of these different foods, it was great. And people said, do you miss anything? I said, no, the reverse. I've found all this stuff. And I really, really enjoyed it. So fast forward 34 years, something like that. And the same feeling came over me. I watched Andrea Arnold's film Cow and read about the environmental impact of the dairy industry and a UN report that was around
huge,
at the time.
That's absolutely
horrendous.
Huge. Yeah.
And I thought, I don't want to be part of it. And so I largely went vegan, and instead of doors opening, they closed. It became difficult to find the foods. Was the ghee in the curry? Was there something listed down the ingredients? Where all of the vegan products really, you know,
I think if I was, I think this is where I'd be, actually, Gary. Is if it had ever quite kicked in on a big enough scale to turn me vegetarian. So I mentioned honey at the outset, but you've done a better job there, because it's such a faff to be a vegan, isn't it?
It is. But there was one or two tipping points as well. I tried every variety of vegan cheese, but they all tasted like PVC.
No, there's no such thing as vegan cheese.
No, there really isn't. But there are other things like vegan cream substitutes, which aren't bad. I still have oat milk in the cappuccino and stuff like this.
Why do you think, because I want to catch up on what has been going on with Boris Johnson. I want to squeeze in one.
Of course.
But why do you think the rest of the world has dialed down the enthusiasm for veganism?
I think it's possible, well, from my experience, it's a little bit difficult, and you miss some things that, frankly, life is too short to miss.
So, okay. So, I mean, this is about as close to anecdata as we ever get on the programme. What we haven't got is a broader, maybe it is just loads and loads of individual dissatisfactions combining to create a sort of nationwide statistic, a nationwide decline in the number of people signing up for it. Gary, stay safe. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where Natasha Clark is here for a quick update on... Well, I said to Eleanor, ask Natasha if he said anything interesting. So the pressure's on you.
I think it's been interesting, James. And I think earlier today, sort of, I thought that probably my theory was the longer that Boris Johnson went on and the longer he was questioned, the more testy
I thought
and
that
upset
in the news
he was
bulletin.
Going to
I
become.
I didn't want to say it because I wasn't watching the whole thing, but he sounded a bit more...
But he was, and I think he became a little bit more rattled as time went on. And I think he has been forced to admit that obviously things were not as perfect as he'd like to believe that they were. I think, you know, he wants to think and he wants to look back and think that both he and the government did the best they could in the circumstances. Obviously, so many people will disagree with that. But he has admitted a few things in the last hour or two. Firstly, that the system for deciding exams was a disaster for children.
It was not a good system. We should not have put it through. We should have spotted it faster. I mean, I think that your criticisms are valid. All I would say is that, you know, you try coming up with a system to give a fair exam result for people when they can't sit exams. It's not easy. Okay? That's all I would say.
I think we can all agree the real victim here is him.
Yeah, for sure.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can hear the frustration in his voice, can't you, there? That he just, you know, believed, and he still believes, that the situation that he found himself in, that he let out, believed that he didn't have any other option but to do this. But obviously it is, of course, a lot easier in hindsight to look back at these things. And of course, on the issue of children, which of course is what this entire module has been focusing on, looking at the impact of young children, he also admitted that he thought that the rules around social distancing around children had gone too far.
I think that you're making a fair point about the rules generally. I think that looking back on it all, the whole lockdowns, the intricacy of the rules, the rule of six, the complexity, particularly for children, I think we probably did go too far, and it was far too elaborate. And maybe we could have found a way of exempting children. It's a very fair point.
The bits of it were bonkers, weren't they? Do you remember the pubs where you could have a pie but not a pasty, or you could do this but not that?
God, and then that was just that nightmare ludicrous, trying to understand those rules, wasn't it?
Was Rishi Sunak's hideously lethal enthusiasm?
Eat out to help out,
which at the time you sort of sat there thinking, this can't be a very good idea.
But it goes to the heart of...
They went too far in some areas and not far enough in others.
Yeah, and it goes to the heart of what the government were trying to do. And a tough job, right? Trying to keep an economy open, keep people safe, keep kids learning, and balance all of those priorities at once. And I think some of the messages that will probably hit the headlines and the front pages tomorrow are these angry text messages that Boris Johnson sent at the time, at the very height of some of the crisis at the Department for Education about the exam system. He talked about wanting to fire ministers to get a new permanent secretary at the Department for Education.
And it begins, we need a plan for the Department of Education. We need a perm sec and we need better ministers. And quite frankly, we need an agenda of reform. We can't go on like this. I'm thinking of going into number 10 and firing people. Mr. Johnson, that reveals the truth, doesn't it, of what you thought about how the leadership of the Department for Education was during the pandemic.
It certainly reveals that I was in, you know, at that particular moment when I fired off that particular intemperate message, I was in a very bad mood about what had happened. Yeah, that'd be fair.
And without going into the details of it, the permanent secretary did leave, correct?
That's correct.
But you didn't ask Sir Gavin Williamson to leave, did you?
Not then, no.
Ought you to have done?
Well, you know, I think if I look back at the general handling of my beloved colleagues over the 3 years or three and a bit years I was in government, I can think of all sorts of changes I might have made.
That's not quite a huge defence of his former colleague, Gavin Williamson.
Who he appointed. So, you know,
really
the subtext there is, appoint Gavin Williamson to do a job, it's done appallingly. Whose fault is it?
Yeah, exactly. And he didn't get rid of him. And like I say, the permanent secretary did eventually leave. But, you know, total blame game at the heart of government. And Boris Johnson was read out those messages. And on screen, it was shown that he was in, that the fiasco had left him, quote, in a homicidal mood when he was considering all of these things. Total chaos at the heart of government, and we know that from all of these messages.
Chaos and agrees. And there's still a phone missing, isn't there? Isn't there another phone that's got more messages on it that never actually...
Was this the second phone of Boris Johnson's?
Never popped up, yeah, never actually appeared.
This was the first was meant to be his work phone, which he claimed that thousands and thousands of messages had basically been deleted from that phone and could not been recovered. He says that he did not perform a factory reset on that phone. I believe you're right, there was a second phone, a personal phone of Boris Johnson that I don't believe has ever been presented over to the COVID inquiry.
Of course, Boris Johnson is an incredibly honest person who has never lied, as all of his ex-wives would attest. Thank you. That is pretty much it for today. Although I suppose I should read this out. Hi, James. Papia. I love you very much, but truly the heroism and intelligence, the quick thinking award and the accolades should really be for your wife. If she hadn't initially thought that the cat could be under the floorboards, you wouldn't be telling this bravery story. All you did was crowbar and a bit of lifting. The cat would know that the true great saviour is actually Mrs. O'Brien. Please don't diss me for giving the true credit to your other half. Thank you. Great show as always. Can we ban that person from sending in text, please? Have we got the technology to do that? Because I never want to hear another word from you again. If you missed any of today's show, including the cat story, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinions, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from this show every day. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, Asma Mir is in for Tom, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
I saved a cat once from the top of an electricity substation when I was about 10 years of age.
That's possibly better than what I did.
But stupid.
More dangerous.
My mother didn't speak to me for about a month.
Did you carry it down?
My friend and I, Lynn, if she's listening, we manufactured a little, you know, like a half a bit of guttering, a bit of broken guttering for the cat to walk down, and we on the top and on the bottom.
Sensational.
And we got a box of jellies from Mrs. Miggins, whose cat it was.
I bet you did. Did you sell the film rights?
Yeah. My mother didn't speak to me for about a month. suicidal bravery. Anyway, thank you very much, James. That story that you've been hearing Boris Johnson talk about, I'm going to pick up at 3 and talk about the impact of school closures, because I know they're still very much being felt At two, the locations of the Pizza Hut restaurants and delivery sites to close across the UK have been revealed. Over 1,000 people will lose their jobs. The high street, we talk about quite a lot, don't we, and the effects the economic situation is having on them. What about hospitality? If you work in hospitality, just how tough is it? And as the rest of us struggle with housing costs, Prince Andrew, it turns out, lives rent-free, effectively, at Windsor. I'd drop a few titles for that, wouldn't you? I've got the book in front of me here by Virginia Roberts Jeffrey. We'll hear more about that later as well.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Boris Johnson has told the COVID inquiry closing schools during the pandemic was a personal horror but felt unavoidable. The former Prime Minister says young people have missed life chances as a result.
I was always grimly reconciled to the possibility that we would have to do all sorts of things that I really didn't want to do. You know, I've got to say that given the huge damage that the closures have done, you've got to ask yourself now whether we could have found other ways of reducing the budget of risk.
He's also admitted the way exam grades were calculated was well-intentioned but clearly failed. Prince Andrew is facing further pressure over his royal titles and living arrangements. It's emerged he's paid only a peppercorn rent on his 30-room mansion on the Windsor estate for the last 20 years. Andrew, who denies wrongdoing, is facing fresh scrutiny over claims in his accuser Virginia Giuffre's posthumous memoir. Jack Royston, chief royal correspondent at Newsweek, says he's not out of the woods yet.
If the Metropolitan Police are taking a look at, which does not quite mean yet investigating, these claims that he asked his police protection officer to dig up dirt on Virginia. We don't know what he says about it. He might well deny it. But there is a real prospect that anybody considered to be involved in a conspiracy to commit misconduct in a public office could be hauled in.
Two more men have been arrested in connection with the death of former Lost Prophets frontman Ian Watkins. The 48-year-old, who was serving a 29-year sentence for child sexual offences, died after an alleged attack at HMP Wakefield earlier this month. The business secretary has denied the country is broke under Labour after public sector borrowing increased to more than £20 billion last month. That's the highest September figure for 5 years. The cost of debt interest, public services and benefits all increase compared with the year earlier. And women on hormone replacement therapy for at least 10 years before their final period may have a lower risk of developing breast cancer. A study in the US found those on HRT also had around a 60% lower risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 31 points at 94.35. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.15. LBC weather staying cool and cloudy for many with patchy rain or showers. A few sunny spells between the showers, especially in the south, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I've finally got my hands on today a copy of the book by Virginia Roberts Jeffrey and her co-author, because Virginia sadly took her own life 6 months ago. It's called Nobody's Girl, a memoir of surviving abuse and fighting for justice. And it has not made things any easier for Prince Andrew. Her co-author is speaking to Emily Maitlis, possibly as we speak, but certainly soon anyway. And I'll talk to Emily about 3:30 when she's spoken to her, to Amy Wallace, who has been speaking about this since the book came out, she emphasises, Amy Wallace, that Virginia did not only have her sights on Prince Andrew when she made her allegation. She was talking about the wider issue of other people who were involved in Epstein's affairs and benefiting from Epstein's trafficking of people like her. But she was also wanting to make the point that powerful men and women, powerful people, shouldn't have the capacity to destroy the lives of others simply because they are wealthy and connected. So there's an awful lot to this here in the UK, as well as all of that. There is the whole question, many questions still swirling around Prince Andrew and what should or will happen next. It's emerged that he's been living pretty much rent-free for 20 years in a 30-room mansion on the Windsor estate. Not in the castle itself, but on a house on the estate. And we've known that he's lived there at the essential, you know, the gift, I suppose, of the royal family, of the king. But not quite that it's been essentially rent-free all of that time, apart from a peppercorn rent. So it really does beg the question, doesn't it, that what we know about the financing of his life and what he should do next, because the royal family are clearly wanting this to be as far removed from their activities, you know, their job for the country as possible. You might recall back in 2024, there was a Channel 4 programme, Dispatches, that put the spotlight on the Duchy of Lancaster and the Duchy of Cornwall, so the monarchs and the Prince of Wales estates, both established back in the 1300s. And they exist to raise money for the sovereign and his or her heir, the Prince of Wales, by giving them all the net profits. In Dispatches, the King, the Prince and their secret millions, it certainly sparked debate by investigating exactly what makes these royals such hefty personal sums from all of this. There was a commitment then by Prince Charles and the Prince of Wales to look again at how it all operated. The degree to which anything has changed it isn't something that's particularly been made public, I don't think, unless I missed it. What do you think should happen? What do you think should happen now on the financial front as much as the honours front? I think the question around the title Prince and HRH still hovers over Andrew would be my argument. But what do you think should happen with the money? What's funding this life? And what exactly was that $12 million payout settlement to Virginia Giuffre? What did that consist of? We don't know fully about that either. Norman Baker joins me, former Home Office Minister and author of And What Do You Do? What the Royal Family Don't Want You to Know, and the upcoming book Royal Mint, National Debt. That's coming out next month. Norman Baker, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Does any of this surprise you, or any of these questions swirling around the Prince and how his life is?
Not really. I mean, Andrew's been a walking disaster area for many years. His finances have been opaque. He's associated with dubious characters and visited dubious regimes when he was supposed to be battling for Britain as trade envoy. He has got a peppercorn rent, as you say, on Royal Lodge. 30 bedrooms, by the way, for him and Fergie to rattle around in. Him at one end, in one wing, and her on the other end, the other wing. And he, in return for that, he's got a 75-year lease on the building, and he is obliged under the lease to maintain it and indeed improve it. And he has, to be fair, spent some millions on the building.
Of his own money?
Well, we don't know his money, but money that he has access to.